Case number 12-1232 et al. South Carolina Public Service Authority Petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Session 1, Issue 1. Threshold Issues. Mr. Ryder for Petitioner, South Carolina Public Service Authority et al. Arguing Planning Mandate. Mr. Tunnel for Petitioner, Southern Company Services, arguing Need for Rule. Mr. Elliott, for Interveners, American Public Power Association, et al., arguing public policy issues. And Ms. Vixella, for Respondent, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The Commission's directive in Order 1000 that utilities engage in and enter into regional planning agreements, whether in the exercise of their business judgment they choose to or not, is unlawful because, as this Court has said on numerous occasions and as the Supreme Court has said, Congress rejected a pervasive regulatory scheme when it passed the Federal Power Act in favor of voluntary commercial relationships devised by the utilities themselves. The Commission's order rests on two completely unsustainable premises. First, the Commission maintains that Section 202A, which concedes, is a bar to mandating coordination of facilities or power pooling agreements, which the Commission correctly equates with coordination of facilities, does not apply to coordination of planning. Hurdling that, it says, well, it explicitly recognizes that it needs to have an affirmative source of authority, which it claims to find in Section 206, which it concedes is limited to regulating existing utility practices. There are three fundamental problems with the Commission's propositions. The first is with respect to Section 202A. This Court has ruled on several occasions in Central Iowa, in Atlantic City, again in the California ISO case, that Section 202A bars the Commission from entering into pooling, ordering entities to enter into pooling arrangements or coordination, including.
Is your 202 argument Chevron 1 or 2?
Both, Your Honor. Both. Under Chevron 1, this Court has said that Congress plainly intended that coordination of facilities, which this Court, in fact, recognized included planning arrangements, was that Congress explicitly barred the Commission from mandating that utilities engage in planning. And whether they used the word.
Did we say that on a Chevron 1 analysis?
I think that there, Your Honor, I would refer this Court to its decision in New York versus EPA, which we've cited in our briefs. What the Court said there is that even in pre-Chevron cases where the Court may use the words plain or expressly or plainly, that those are the equivalent of saying that the statute is unambiguous and that there's no need to invoke the magic word ambiguous to find that.
So what is the language in 202 that supports your argument that FERC has gone beyond its congressional authority here mandating this process?
What this Court has found, and what in Central Iowa and in relying on the Supreme Court's decisions in Permian Basin and Otter Tail, what this Court said in the Duke Power case was that the language referring to the Commission's duty to encourage coordination of facilities was read clearly and plainly to mean that that's all they could do. They could encourage but could not mandate coordination.
And so that's, let's turn to 206. 206A?
Yes, Your Honor.
What do you think Congress had in mind when it spoke of giving the Commission authority as to a practice that would affect the justness and fairness of rates?
It plainly contemplated that the Commission could regulate those practices that utilities voluntarily entered into or devised on their own. In fact, that was the issue.
So you're reading into both 202 and 206 a requirement of a prior voluntary agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, there are limited exceptions. The Commission, as this Court pointed out in Central Iowa, can order interconnections.
Let's look at the text of 206.
Uh-huh.
All right, whenever the Commission, after hearing, shall find that a practice affecting such rate charge classification is unjust, the commission shall determine, oh, and shall fix by order. So what has the commission done here that's inconsistent with those words in that statute?
Well, what it has done, it is, has actually ordered the utilities to enter into a new practice, assuming for sake of argument that
isn't that an issue in the challenge to order 888? And in fact, we said that can be done. Right? That was the very argument that we rejected.
No, I think that's quite different. In Order 888, what the court upheld was the commission's authority to remedy undue discrimination. So that if utilities, I think the premise for Order 888 was that utilities were already offering transmission service either to themselves or to others, and that the court found that they could remedy undue discrimination by eliminating that discrimination. And I think this court's decision in California ISO.
But as a result of 888, weren't new relationships entered into that hadn't been existed?
Yes, to eliminate undue discrimination. That's in fact, I think I would agree with you there, but they didn't.
So the commission here would have to find that the practice that affects on rates is undue discrimination? That's the only authority 206 gives it?
It can regulate unreasonable practices, assuming, again, for purposes of argument that joint planning itself is a practice. And I think this court spoke directly to that same point in interpreting Central Iowa in the California ISO case, where it says that
in which?
In California, yeah.
Okay. That's the one about the internal governance, board of governors?
Yeah, it dealt with whether Section 206A allowed the commission to treat as a practice the utility's decision.
That really is too far removed.
Well,
say that it falls within the scope of something effective.
But I think the language of this court explains why this is also 10
right.
steps removed. What it said was that they're interpreting Central Iowa, it said that FERC conditioned the approval of the power pool on removal of the membership criteria rather than ordering the pool to change those criteria directly. Here is FERC has taken even a more extreme step. Rather than merely threatening to revoke the ISO status if it did not remove the board, it similarly did what it did in Central Iowa. It has instead decided to order the ISO directly to change its board. Here, that's exactly what the commission is doing. It's ordering entities to enter into new agreements, whether in their business judgment they would choose to or not, to coordinate with others. It's ordering them to define the scope of the arrangements. That was expressly rejected by the commission itself and affirmed by this court in Central Iowa.
You don't quarrel with the fact that planning does affect the rates, though, right? Does affect rate.
Lots of things affect rates. Their decision
has a pretty direct effect
manufacturer
on it.
Does the same thing.
It works better if you stop when I.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe I could make myself a little more clear. Maybe I wasn't clear enough. It affects rates. Now you say, well, everything affects rates. The center. It's a pretty direct effect on rates. Planning does, haven't it? I mean that. That's not your quarrel, is it, that it doesn't affect, that this practice doesn't affect?
No, Your Honor, I think we could accept for purposes of the argument here that the commission can regulate planning as a practice. We'll assume that, but it doesn't overcome the problem that the whole statute is premised on voluntary commercial relationships.
But the relationships remain voluntary. There's no ordering of any actor to enter into any agreement with anyone else or
that's
to construct anything, or it's just a planning requirement.
No,
the plan
it's not,
can't be carried out. The plan can be left on a shelf.
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. In fact, as the commission explained in describing the difference between the planning criteria that it adopted in Order 890 and in this case, it's made this a binding obligation that they have to enter into a plan that meets all of the criteria, including have to accept binding cost allocation. They have to get rid of rights of first refusal that the commission itself approved. They have to enter.
Wait, I understand that the planning is not voluntary, but you're pointing to language in the Federal Power Act that talks about voluntary interconnection and coordination of facilities.
Yes.
And any interconnection or coordination of the actual delivery of power on transmission lines remains fully voluntary. And, or at least that would be FERC's argument, no? And I guess I'd be interested in your response.
What they're saying is that they're not mandating coordination of the operation of the facilities, but somehow they have power in a statute that was intended to encourage voluntary coordination that they have the authority to mandate, even after 50 or 60 years in which the commission has said exactly the opposite.
So let me ask you, go back to Section 206 with me, if you will. What does the phrase, quote, shall fix the same by order, close quote?
It means shall fix the same rate that the commission deems to be reasonable by order. And rate, for purposes of the argument here, rate includes rate, terms and conditions of service and the like.
So even though this court has interpreted Section 206 based on the plain language of 206 to give the commission authority to initiate investigations into practices.
Of existing practices.
Excuse me?
Yeah, to initiate investigations of existing practices.
Right. And once it makes a finding about those practices, what does this phrase, shall fix the same by order, mean in your view?
In my view, it means that they get to correct what's unreasonable about the order. But what this court...
So just let me carry through. So if, hypothetically, the commission gives notice, an opportunity for comment on its findings about a practice that it determines adversely affects the fairness and justness of rates, then the commission shall fix the same by order, comma, only to the extent that, and you finished the phrase for me.
Only to the extent that it doesn't override other prohibitions in the Act. I think that's precisely the type of issue that this Court confronted in the net neutrality case. It found some limited authority to regulate broadband providers, but it said it was going a step too far when it made them common carriers.
So what is the language in the statute that is being conflicted here?
Well, what conflicts is the prohibition in Section 202A, and that's what this Court, in fact, held in Central Iowa. There, the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission had said, look, the commission's order doesn't direct the utilities to engage in single system planning, and it should have, and that was...
Go back to 202A. Just help me through the statute here.
Sure.
And it says, quote, and it may at any time thereafter, upon its own motion or upon application, make such modification thereof as in its judgment will promote the public interest. Now, you would agree that's pretty broad, isn't it?
Yes, but it's not unbounded.
And then it goes on to say that the limitation Congress addresses is it shall be the duty of the commission to promote and encourage such interconnection and coordination. And so the commission comes back and tells us, it says, that's all very well and good, but 202 doesn't say anything about planning.
Yes,
it's talking about interconnection.
Yeah, the commission, in fact, and this gets to the Chevron Step 2 question, the commission, in fact, says that the statute doesn't refer to planning. It doesn't refer to operations either. But the commission has said, in fact, it's spent millions of dollars and devoted its staff resources for decades to promoting voluntary coordination, which it is plainly included to contemplated that was planning. And the commission concedes that it can't order pooling arrangements. It says we're barred by 202A. There's no air between us on that. The question is whether pooling arrangements or coordination of facilities includes planning. And the commission's unexplained, in fact, unacknowledged flip-flop on that point renders its interpretation per se unreasonable under Chevron. So it loses under Chevron 2, even if this Court were to conclude that the meaning of the phrase coordination of facilities it was ambiguous. So they would lose under Chevron Step 1 or Step 2. I know I've exceeded my time, but I did, if I could just briefly address the question of the disruptive nature or what the impact of vacating Order 1000 in its entirety, which is what
we
would ask the Court to do.
We've taken up some of your time with questions, I realize, but, you know, you are eating into your rebuttal time.
In that case, Your Honor, I will I'll ask
we'll
for...
We'll give you rebuttal time.
Thank you.
All right.
May it please the Court. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, FERC-based Order 1000 solely on a theoretical threat. But FERC's theoretical basis violates FERC's own test that it articulated in Order 1000 because the order is based just on speculation. And FERC's theoretical basis also violates the high standard that this Court established in the BNSF and National Fuel decision because the theoretical threat that FERC asserts is not undetectable, but to the contrary, the theoretical threat is factually verifiable. And the theoretical basis that FERC asserts is that existing transmission planning processes are deficient and may fail to identify superior transmission alternatives, which in turn might make rates unjust and unreasonable. But that speculative basis, or that theoretical basis, violates FERC's own test that it articulated in Order 1000. That test is articulated at page 52 of FERC's brief. And what it provides is that FERC must establish that its predictions will occur with sufficient frequency and to a sufficient degree to conclude that the reforms are needed. But FERC here has failed to satisfy that very test that it articulates because Order 1000 is predicated upon speculation that its requirements may, might, or could result in improvements. And such speculation provides no basis to conclude either that existing
they didn't use may, might, or could all the time. They did sometime because they recognized they were painting with a broad brush, right? So that, isn't that unfair to suggest that everything they did was couched in terms of
may, might? The order is replete with may, might, or could.
And many times. What's the explanation FERC gives for why they say that? They address that.
Well, they address it by saying that they satisfy that test. But if you look at how they satisfy that test, Your Honor, it's on page 52. Once they articulate the test, you would think the next step would to say, and this is a reasonable prediction because, but then the very next sentence, what they say is they raise the incantation of agency expertise. And Your Honor, respectfully submit that agency expertise alone is not sufficient to satisfy that test. The Federal Power Act and Administrative Procedures Act both require substantial evidence and that the order not be arbitrary and capricious. It doesn't provide just agency expertise.
So if you look at the rulemaking record here and the comments that were submitted and the other evidence about the problems that existed in planning and at least from the agency's point of view, the efficient investment with regard to future transmission facilities, what specifically is lacking?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that they're all references to the facts, FERC disavows facts. If you look at paragraph 53 of Order 1000, they make it very clear that they're relying solely on a theoretical basis, Your Honor.
But we have defined the theoretical basis, as has in terms of there being a reasonable basis for the assumptions leading to the prediction. So here, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I understood the agency to be saying during the notice and comment period, we received these comments about problems with regard to the planning that is or isn't going on for regional planning of new facilities. And you represent a region where, as I understand it, FERC has acknowledged that you're doing well. And part of your argument is, so there's no need for a national rule. And FERC's response is, in part, we're just setting minimum requirements. So given that that's at least the agency's approach, what's missing in the record that they would need to proceed on a theoretical threat basis?
Well, Your Honor, you raised a couple of points there. To take one point first, the reference to reasonably tailored, they do make a reference to how I reach in the Southeast. There's implications that they agree that we really don't have any problems and they're just establishing minimum standards.
Does that fact defeat the agency's ability to proceed on the basis of a theoretical threat? In other words, one part of the country, one region, is basically doing what FERC concludes all regions should be doing. Does that mean that that defeats the premise of a theoretical threat?
Well, it means that the order is not reasonably tailored, Your Honor.
Okay, but I'm sorry, I know I've thrown a lot at you.
Right.
Going back to your first point mm-hmm. about the agency's just relying on speculation,
mm-hmm.
This is a friendly question.
Yeah.
In terms of you're representing a region that the agency acknowledges is doing well. So as I understand it, you're up here to argue about there's no need for this rule. And the agency says, well, you may be doing okay, but, you know, we have a national problem here.
Well, Your Honor, still have failed to demonstrate the problem, Your Honor, because the whole problem assumes – go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, the whole problem assumes that there is some quantum of superior transmission alternatives out there that is going to be missed. You know, that's the problem they assert. But to put it in the terms of BNSF and National Fuel, that problem is not undetectable. And so that's where the theory starts to fall apart, because if there really are superior transmission alternatives out there that are going to be missed, that's verifiable today, because that's what transmission planning is all about. Transmission planning makes a future prediction.
No, but FERC's point is not all of the relevant parties participate in that planning, and that's the deficiency. If this is going back too far for you, but, you know, when we had one telephone company, reliable service, but then it was broken up, and look what's happened since. So a lot of things that we have now we didn't have back when just one company was doing it. And that's
right.
Sort of the theory here, that if you have more players, there are more alternatives.
The Southeastern Utilities, we weren't the only petitioners to demonstrate that our existing planning processes are more than adequate. FPPC, for example, they presented facts that transmission planning is very vibrant, not only in the Southeast, but also in the West.
So just help me out here. Your premise, then, is that there cannot be a theoretical threat on which an agency can proceed where there is acknowledged evidence that planning is being done well even if there is record evidence of problems elsewhere?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, there's some cases lend themselves to theory. Other cases demand facts. The issue that FERC raises about deficient planning, that is a fact-specific issue because the problem is detectable. And here, if you run through it, it's not just that the problem is detectable. You have countervailing facts, and it's not just from the Southeast. Again, it's also LPPC. Several transmission owners.
What was the last reference?
Oh, LPPC.
L-what?
Yes, Your Honor. They presented evidence at pages 663 through 79 of the Joint Appendix. Several of the transmission owners and RTOs, they also presented evidence that they're having ropers is not preventing the identification of appropriate transmission alternatives. So there's plenty of countervailing evidence demonstrating not only in the Southeast but around the country that FERC's premise is incorrect. And then also, Your Honor, that just in terms of a theory, this is not appropriate for a theory because if you look at the cases that have allowed generic fact-finding, for example, AGD and TAPS, you know, there what the agency was doing lended itself to generic fact-finding because the underlying theory was good. I mean, you know, the example always given in AGD is that FERC doesn't have to do a, you know, specific experiments to demonstrate
that. What's the flaw in the underlying theory here?
There's several flaws, Your Honor. The competition theory, for example, you know, if you look at AGD and TAPS, FERC was introducing competition into a market that had become competitive. Here, FERC is not doing that. FERC is introducing competition into a market that remains a natural monopoly. And as this court recognized in National Fuel.
Excuse me, the acoustics are not great here.
Yeah, it's kind of.
And I'm missing the last part of your sentence. If you can say.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm, the point I'm saying is FERC relies on competition theory. That's one of the underlying theories. But they've misapplied competition theory because they're not introducing competition into a competitive market. They're introducing competition into a natural monopoly.
But they're trying to foster some amount of new entrants, and they have a theory for that. And I understand you know, that when they're saying a theoretical threat and reaching the conduct that they're seeking to reach, it, they're exercising a broad authority. But it also seems like this is just the kind of situation in which it would be arguably irresponsible for a regulator not to require detailed planning in advance, to wait until problems arise. Then we're going to be way into some costs, investments that are disorganized, uncoordinated. So isn't this the ideal situation where so much investment is predicted and there's so much need for coordination precisely to, you know, seek where they can to remove barriers to entry and base it on some economic predictions?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that premise because here the problem is not that they don't have to wait to see if there's going to be a problem. Again, transmission planning, the whole nature of transmission planning is we're making a future prediction. I mean, we're making a prediction that goes out 10 years. I mean, today we're addressing transmission planning the types of challenges that FERC raises in Order 1000.
But what about the evidence that they're overlapping facilities, that some of the plans aren't well coordinated, et cetera? Can the agency not look to that as evidence to address some of the issues that Judge Pillar just mentioned?
Well, again, FERC has disavowed evidence here. They're relying solely on their theory. But even if there were circumstances where one or two utilities may not be coordinating, that's not a sufficient predicate for a nationwide rulemaking that's going to adversely affect large portions of the United States. That's not a reasonably tailored order. Instead, put it in the context and the language of National Fuel, that's when individual adjudications and investigations would be appropriate. That's the reasonably tailored approach to addressing those type of individual coordination problems.
So your future is 20, 30 years down the road. FERC gets all these tariff filings and has to just disapprove them because the rates are unjust and unreasonable. Because if you look at where it started back here in 2012, they know that things could have been done more efficiently and effectively had there been this coordinated planning, taking into account some of the factors and considering some of the issues that FERC has identified.
Your Honor, that you're starting with the premise that there's a problem. I mean, you're jumping straight to the solution.
I'm starting with the premise that there is record evidence before the agency that, what was it, the Brattle Group that said, you know, 130 projects are overlapping and not well coordinated. We're talking about huge investments. We're talking about major expansion. We're talking about changes in the nature of the energy source. And FERC knows all this now. And so I'm just trying to understand why Congress would pass a statute that tells the agency that if you, after notice and hearing and all that, find that in your expert judgment, where we've delegated this authority to the agency, that there's a problem with the practice, and we want you to fix it by order, that the agency just has to sit on its hands.
No, Your Honor. The FERC is required to predicate its orders upon substantial evidence. I mean, that's one of the requirements that Congress put on FERC. And so the premise that you're putting forward, it really does assume that there is a problem. And the point I'm trying to make is if there really is a problem in transmission planning, that is detectable today.
No, it's premised on that the agency to whom Congress has delegated this responsibility has determined, after following the procedures Congress required, that there is a problem. That's the premise.
But again, FERC does not have untethered authority to require extensive revisions throughout the industry just because in their expertise they think that a certain way is better for us to do our business. that they still have to comply with substantial evidence. They still have to make a rational connection between the order and the facts found, and that's what's lacking here. I mean, there's substantial countervailing evidence, and the underlying problem that they assert is detectable. Again, transmission studies could be done, and that's the whole point of Order 890.
You say the underlying problem is detectable.
It is detectable, yes, Your Honor.
Why haven't they detected it?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit because there's not a problem.
All right, so this is it's just a circular argument. You just disagree with the agency's conclusion after giving everybody a chance to comment on this proposal.
No, Your Honor, what I'm submitting is if there really was a problem, it would have come out through the rulemaking process. I mean, after all, they did two full rounds of notice and comment. They conducted multiple technical conferences. And so if there really was a problem, again, all that has to be done is transmission studies. Order 890 made our transmission planning process as open and transparent, which means all the data that an engineer needs to run a study is out there. Right. And that was the point of 890. And all so right. If we really were missing alternatives, that should have been brought forward.
Although, is FERC's position that the alternatives are being deterred from coming forward by the situation under 890, and that's why they needed to introduce a few additional reforms, the right of first refusal and the cost allocation rule, and that you're not going to see alternatives that are being overlooked because they're not going to come forward under the conditions that prevail?
Well, again, Order 890 made all our planning processes open and transparent, so it's not like it's a closed gate.
Right.
And so if any interested merchant transmission developer, if a affected customer thinks that it's being, you know, precluded from markets, all the data is out there. And so you just have to sign a confidentiality agreement. You can have the data. And if pretty motivated people, if the service is really that bad, they will be motivated to do
the
studies.
Is the issue whether the service is that bad, or isn't the issue whether FERC has the authority to look ahead and look it out on the horizon and say, you know, things are pretty good right now, but look what's coming?
Right, but that's my point, Your Honor. Right now, even go back in 2009, again,
transmission. You said they haven't done that. They haven't looked out on the horizon.
That's right. Transmission planning, it looks out on the horizon. I mean, we're planning right now for the future challenges that they assert in the order. We did that last year. We did that in 2009. Mm-hmm. Those studies are out there. They're posted on websites. Mm-hmm.
So
they can download the data and run the studies.
So is your point that nothing new would be added to the planning process?
All right, it's not just that, Your Honor. I mean, what FERC is going to do, FERC is going to break what works. I mean, if you look at the evidence we submitted, even the DOE's 2009 congestion study, I mean, it lauded the Southeast for the effective planning that we have. What FERC is doing is breaking a system that works and is replacing it with a very bureaucratic and litigious process. And that's the point raised by Commissioner Clark in his opinion in the Tampa Electric case that we cited. He raises a concern that what FERC is going to do is going to bring forth a litigious and bureaucratic process, and what that means is you're not going to have more efficient transmission, you're going to have less.
All right. I think we have your argument, and we'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Order 1000 also mandates that public utility transmission planning consider transmission needs driven by public policy requirements. And this mandate is distinct from the regional planning mandate and even broader because it also applies to local transmission planning. So it's a distinct element of the order. The issue of whether it contravenes Section 217B4 of the Federal Power Act is important beyond the confines even of this case, because that statute applies to any exercise of FERC's authority under the Part 2 of the Federal Power Act. Congress added this provision in 2005. It requires that FERC shall exercise its authority in a particular manner that facilitates the planning and expansion of transmission facilities to meet the reasonable needs of load-serving entities to satisfy their service obligations. Yet here, FERC refused to prescribe any public policy requirement, including this one, as mandatory in the transmission planning process.
So is this your vagueness argument?
Pardon me?
I'm just trying to see, is this your statutory or your vagueness argument?
I didn't quite understand. It's a statutory argument. But our argument is they failed to implement this provision of the statute
in this
process.
What about FERC's response on rehearing?
Well, the response I'm hearing is that essentially that this process will benefit everybody, and therefore it will also help load-serving entities. Our response to that is, well, it may do that, but only by accident, because you have a specific provision that Congress added to govern transmission planning. They added to the statute in 2005, and you've made it optional. It doesn't even have to be required, considered in the process that you've mandated. So how can you be saying that you've implemented this statute faithfully?
I'm not sure I entirely follow, because you're talking about 217B4, right?
217B4, yes.
Which requires FERC to act in a way that facilitates the planning and expansion of transmission facilities to meet the reasonable needs of load-serving entities to satisfy the service obligations of the load-serving entities.
That's correct.
Load-serving entities are absolutely have a place at the table in the planning
yes.
process.
Yes.
And I imagine everyone involved in
well, they can provide
energy
yes.
transmission
yeah.
is concerned about the load-serving entity's ability to meet the needs of customers. And at the end of the day, that's the project, right? So is there? So they're in there. Your clients are involved fully. What impairs? What about the planning process do you see as an impediment to the ability of load-serving entities to satisfy their service obligations?
It's true. They can provide input. They can suggest that our transmission needs need to be addressed, but the order doesn't require that that input be heeded.
Well, on rehearing,
the planning process can go into a different direction and ignore those needs. That's the legal requirement. I mean, that's all FERC has said here.
It could, although the planning process is something that the commission leaves to the stakeholders to devise.
Yes, well, they could be outvoted, perhaps, on a particular project.
They could have specially weighted voting. We don't actually know because FERC hasn't actually prescribed anything on that.
Yes, but FERC is not required that the transmission needs specified in the statute be considered, period.
It is required that they all needs be considered. As I read it, it requires that all needs be considered. And I guess maybe another way of asking my question is, what would it look like if they had done this right? How would a special place at the table be created that would meet your client's interpretation of 217B4?
Yes. Well, it's not just a place at the table. It's a place that in the plan that results from the process. The planning process has to result in the transmission needs of load-serving entities being met. And they stopped short of doing that with they said in order for it to be flexible enough, we have to be agnostic. We can't prescribe what policies are going to be implemented in the plan or not.
How do you respond to what
the agency said on rehearing? Well, as I said on rehearing, they said this process is going to benefit everybody.
They said there's no change in Order 681. All right. They said it will
yes.
benefit everybody,
mm-hmm.
and they say these needs must be considered.
Well, but it doesn't require that these needs be considered. It requires that they provide input, but it doesn't require that that input be heeded. Order 681, I think, implemented 217 correctly. It interpreted the statute as a whole, paragraph 320 of that order. And it applied this 217B and said obviously, if you read all of 217B as a whole, then obviously special consideration has to be paid to load-serving entities. The specific issue there, which FERC talks about, was allocating existing transmission rights on existing facilities. But the principle they tried, not from the broader reading of the statute. That's what paragraph 320 of that order says.
All right.
Because if they had only wanted to, because they were given a choice of a very narrow preference or a broader one, they opted for a broader one by reading the statute as a whole. And it dealt with planning, too. Paragraph 453 of that order has provisions that govern transmission planning. It wasn't just about existing facilities and the allocation of existing rights.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So now we're going to hear on this issue from the commission.
Beth Pasella for the commission. Good morning, Your Honors. I think I'll start at the last part about 217B4. As Judge Rogers was just saying, the commission explained that the public policy requirements here benefit everyone, and what the statute requires is that load-serving entities' needs be facilitated, and that's what's happened here.
They say that it will just be an option on the table.
People will have meaningful opportunity to present whatever transmission needs they believe are driven by public policy, and FERC interpreting a statute it administers determine that that's all that's required,
so
except regarding firm transmission rights, which is where the preference lies, not regarding all matters. Yes, Your Honor.
How do you respond to their concern that some stakeholder process that they devise, they may be outvoted? They may not be able to meet the needs of the load-serving customers, and isn't that a priority within the statute?
What's a priority is that they have firm transmission rights, is that they be able to get firm transmission rights. It's what the statute requires regarding other matters is that the commission facilitates the planning and expansion of their facilities, and the commission has done so just by issuing Order 1000. That's satisfied.
And if their parade of horribles came to pass, then that's tough luck, or that's something
that
FERC would respond to, or what's next?
They could certainly come to the commission at some point and say, wow, the process that was approved despite our efforts, because, of course, they'll be part of creating the process that selects, you know, that sets up how things will be identified. They'll be part of that process. They'll be part of the process of identifying transmission needs driven by public policy.
Doesn't 217B4 require more than that they be part of the process?
The commission's requiring a meaningful opportunity to be part of the process. So it's more than that. And no, Your Honor, because, again, the word just says facilitates the planning and expansion of their transmission facilities. The rule does that here in a number of ways.
To meet the reasonable needs
of load-serving entities. And just setting up a process where they can identify needs driven. This has never been a requirement before.
To meet their needs, not just so that they can talk about their needs. It's to meet their needs. That sounds to me like the language of preference, like the end result has to be that their needs are met. It's not just process. It's a process that leads to a certain result, isn't it?
It's in a manner that facilitates their ability to meet their needs, not that it guarantees that they will meet their needs. It just facilitates. It's an ambiguous term that the commission determines is satisfied here based on the meaningful opportunity to participate and all of the other benefits that are provided under Order 1000. It's automatically going to happen generally under Order 1000. Their needs are going to be facilitated because of Order 1000. And on top of that, they get to identify, for the first time, there's a requirement that all needs are considered, not just economic and reliability concerns, but that needs driven by public policy requirements, which have been exploding in recent years, are now also mandated to be considered.
I guess they're seeing kind of a tension between meeting those new needs from the new load-serving entities and continuing in a priority way to meet the needs of load-serving entities with contract obligations. In your position, I take it, is a rising tide lifts all boats, including the load-serving boats. And I guess, can you further address why you think it's implausible, the scenario that Mr. Elliott was concerned about, that, you know, maybe not. Maybe a rising tide throws them down the coast in a riptide. I mean, maybe they're really going to be outnumbered by some new interests. Why is that not
regardless
a concern?
Regardless of whether they end up having their identified needs selected for further evaluation and then entered into the transmission planning process for purposes of cost allocation, all that's done, all the statute requires is facilitation to meet their needs. It doesn't require that their needs be met. There's a stark difference between the first part of 217B4, which says that commission shall act in a manner that facilitates.
So,
you
view Congress as just saying you have to think about the LSEs. Don't forget the LSEs. Think about them.
And
that's all Congress was doing here?
Congress wasn't
putting a thumb on the scale and
saying...
I think
it requires a commission finding which the commission made here, which is that what it's doing does facilitate the LSE's needs.
So
meeting their needs.
How is that? I'm sorry.
It's met, as the commission explained, Order 1000 will enhance the transmission planning process and support development of needed transmission facilities, and therefore, consistent with 217B4, will aid load-serving entities in meeting their reasonable transmission needs. So that in and of itself is satisfying.
That's a conclusion. That didn't quite describe how you get there.
Well, the whole purpose of this is to enhance the transmission planning process. I mean, I don't think anyone is saying that these minimum requirements, as a general matter nationwide, will improve the transmission planning process by having regional matters and not just local matters considered in transmission planning and planning things more cost-effectively and efficiently. So that improves the transmission grid, and it creates the ability to bring energy from farther away more efficiently and cost-effectively, which means that rates will go down.
Okay, I thought that was your position, and maybe it's just sort of the lawyer in you. When you read the statute, and I heard a little bit of a tension between your early answer to me, which was, well, if their parade of horribles did come to pass, they would be able to come to FERC and
they could
and get some kind of relief. But then later on you said, well, all this required is facilitation, which is a little bit more of a tough luck answer. And I guess I'm wondering, and I understand your basic position to be, they're not likely to have a problem.
Right.
But, you know, and that's really your main position. But if they did,
then they could come to the commission with a 206 complaint and say the procedures that have been put into effect during the process we participated in and selected, that's no longer just and reasonable. And that happens all the time. I mean, that type of process, obviously, it doesn't happen in the Order 1000 context all the time because it's new, but that happens all the time. Parties always have an opportunity to bring a 206 complaint saying that a practice, a procedure, is no longer just and reasonable. So if that comes to fruition, and the commission would have to look at that.
And what kind of relief might they get if they could show that it wasn't just and reasonable?
The commission could change the process to say, this isn't actually facilitating. If that turned out, this isn't actually facilitating, and maybe the commission would give specific directives, or maybe the commission would give the kind of flexibility to say, you have to do something more that then will solve whatever the specific complaint is, and do it in a flexible manner, because regions are all so different. Mm-hmm.
Could you address the argument that there's not sufficient record evidence of that the processes need fixing?
Sure. I think the main point I wanted to bring up there, Your Honor, is the commission did rely on theoretical threat for sure, but it didn't rely on theoretical threat for its initial premise of the basis on why it's acting now. That's because of the substantial transmission investment that has to happen in the next 20 years. There will be almost $300 billion worth of transmission facilities that need to be built during that time period. So if the commission had evidence for that from the Edison Electric Institute, and it had, that's at JA 350 paragraph 91 in Order 1000A, and also evidence from the Brattle report that was submitted as part of the comments in response to the notice of proposed rulemaking in this case, at JA 157 paragraph 44 and note 36, explaining that a large portion of facilities that are already being planned won't be built because they are they overlap with each other, and so there's just inefficient planning. And so the commission had evidence of that, why it needed to act now, based on its concern that if it doesn't do anything, the transmission that will be built either will not be sufficient or it will be inefficient and not as cost-effective as it could be with this rulemaking.
So what about the argument that, as the commission acknowledges, at least the Southeast region is doing very well, which, to just expand on that point, arguably means that what's in effect now can work satisfactorily. There's no need for this, or at least the need hasn't been demonstrated sufficiently for the agency to have authority to proceed on the basis of a theoretical threat.
The commission explained first that basic principles, such as the proposition that transmission developers will be more likely to invest if there's a cost allocation mechanism in place, apply in every region. So things can be improved anywhere, even if they're working okay now. And the commission further explained that even if things are working well now, if the commission doesn't enforce these changes, these minimum requirements everywhere, these minimum requirements that might require very little change for these regions where they are doing pretty okay right now, then they might be facing such problems in the future. And I think it's exactly right, as one of your honors was saying before, it would really be irresponsible, and that's why FERC acted, to just sit back and say, transmission is a long, complex process to build, and the commission sit back for 20 years, knowing it's going to take so long to plan and build this and how much money it costs, and just sit back and say, oh, maybe it won't be done right. We'll do something about it later. I mean, you really can't do that in this circumstance.
Well, the argument, in part, as I understand it, is that Congress had in mind this notion of voluntary agreements that the market would sort out the inefficiencies, that FERC was a backstop such that if those forces didn't work well and if tariff filings included rates that the commission determined were unfair and unjust, then the commission could act. But that's the system that Congress had in mind, not a system where FERC is in at the beginning, as it were, telling entities how they should plan, how they should act prior to that time.
I'll just start by pointing out what Otter Tail really says about what Congress intended under the Federal Power Act. It said that it rejected a pervasive regulatory scheme for controlling interstate distribution in favor of voluntary commercial relationships.
Some respects, because clearly in the statute there are exceptions.
Right, but its distribution is not what's being affected here in any way, shape, or form. Distribution is moving transmission. It's operational matter. The commission is very clearly standing far from operational matters. And same thing with Central Iowa. That involved a pooling agreement involving operational matters. That's not affected here.
So although isn't it, I mean, in a way it seems like the very importance of the planning that you're mandating is that it really will be the agenda. It's going to have an enormous impact. If a region comes up with a plan and makes decisions on which projects are going to be chosen for cost allocation, that's a tremendously powerful document, even though the commission isn't directly saying what's going to be built. It's a pretty short road from the kind of planning that you're mandating to the result on the ground.
Not always in reality, Your Honor. I mean, I think the commission's hope is that things in the plan are more likely to be built because of all the items put in here, but there really is a stark contrast between what's in a plan and what will necessarily be built. Entities have many choices about whether, even if something ends up in a plan, whether they choose to build it. No one can force them to build something, even if it's selected in the plan for purposes of cost allocation. States don't have to approve facilities, so all kinds of things can happen. The commission just set up a process so that people could be smarter about it. Not that they're being dumb, but they're being more local than they should be for purposes of thinking about the grid as it is today, which really is a far-reaching grid. The circumstances now are different than they were originally. Things are not local like they used to be, and the commission has to understand that and, in its expertise, act to make sure that the practices that are being used will result in just and reasonable rates and rates that are not unduly discriminatory.
An expensive process that requires the hiring of expertise and economic studying and the development of governance structures and convening, and who pays for it?
Ratepayers, I'm sure, you know, if it's proved, we've asked for it, and it, but it's not really expensive at all in comparison to the billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in transmission that would be built without having all this thought put into it. And, you know, so the commission did balance costs and benefits and came out that the costs and benefits are on the side of this order.
So back to Section 206. What is your understanding of the commission's, of the limitations on the commission's authority? You heard me ask counsel about some of the text, which is very broad.
Sure.
And counsel responded by saying, well, the commission obviously can't do anything that would contradict another provision in the statute. What is the limit of authority here that Congress has granted?
Well, we certainly know that what the commission tried to do in the NAACP case is off
right.
limits, and that's because of the lack of direct effect on rates. And here there is a direct effect on rates in all parts of the order. Everything is all about transmission needs, increasing competition, making additional alternatives brought into the process. All of those things will lead to likely lower rates, better grid. And so clearly, while there are things that are outside of FERC's purview under 206, this is not one of them.
So anything relating to transmission and transmission needs?
As long as it's directly related, not something very tangential, you know, paper purchasing.
That directly affects rates.
Right. And this is certainly planning. We're talking about planning. We're talking about cost allocation, transmission planning, cost allocation, rights of first refusal that keep out, create barriers to entry and therefore decrease the number of alternatives that are presented from which you can choose. And so you're missing out on possible alternatives that might be more efficient or more cost effective.
So would you agree that given that Congress has vested the commission with this very broad authority, that there is a burden on the commission to demonstrate more than a theory, but have what I'll call record evidence? And the question is, who decides how much is enough? And the commission here has decided it had enough evidence that things were sufficiently precarious. I mean, I want to understand
right.
where sort of the commission draws the line. The argument is obviously things could always be better. Well,
sure. I think and maybe this will answer, and please let me know if it doesn't, Your Honor. This wasn't done in a vacuum. This wasn't the commission sitting around saying, wow, things could be better. We could have a more efficient, more cost-effective planning system. Let's just impose it. You know, this is a situation where it is undisputed that tremendous amounts of transmission have to be built in the next 20 years. That no one disputes that. There's also record evidence showing that from the Edison Energy Institute.
The argument in part that the commission for a period of years has been concerned about this planning process, that it has tried it on a voluntary basis, and that based on the rulemaking record, what the commission calls deficiencies that it identified in Order 890.
It's not so much that people weren't complying with 890.
Right.
You know, it's that the commission quickly realized, because of the exponential growth in transmission that has to be built, that what it required in 890 and 888 wasn't sufficient to deal with the real-world problems of today.
Where do you stand on whether the National Fuel case sets forth the factors that need to be considered before FERC can act based on a theoretical threat?
The more I read the case, Your Honor, the more case-specific it seems, because the court set out, you know, all kinds of possible theories the commission could come up with in that circumstance and what it would have to show to support that circumstance. I'm not super bothered with that here because the commission answered the matters that the court said needed to be addressed in National Fuel. The commission fully explained why it needed to act now, which is what I was just talking about. It explained that, you know, it explained the cost-benefit analysis, which I've already talked about, and it also explained why it needed to be done nationwide, which I've addressed as well. So all of the factors in National Fuel are addressed.
If National Fuel is, if it sets forth a general standard, if it's not just dicta, let's just go with the argument there. Isn't there a deficiency here in terms of the record evidence? You haven't shown that the present, by the record evidence of the present process is inadequate now, right?
Can I just say one thing before I answer that, Your Honor? I think the BNSF case resolves the concern that that all the factors in National Fuel would be mandatory because the court there affirmed the board's decision just based on one of the three factors, just that, you know, they proved that it would be essentially you just couldn't wait. You had to do it now. You would never be able to – you couldn't – it would be so hard to prove and it would be impossible to kind of go through those processes. And the same exact thing here. The commission found that because of so much transmission is going to be built, it just couldn't sit back and wait, couldn't sit on its hands and let it be built poorly. So it acknowledges that it's not relying for that portion of the case on actual evidence showing that transmission has tremendous problems, but it just couldn't wait, just like in BNSF. So I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
I think the question we'd like to hear a little bit more about is if you did have to look at all the factors, is the showing of the present problem deficient?
Yeah, and again, that's all based on need to act now. So there were anecdotal comments explaining problems, particularly in the rights of first refusal area, and Ms. Perry will be addressing that later this morning. But the commission really based its finding on the undisputed fact that we cannot wait. We know that there essentially there are likely to be problems here, and we cannot satisfy our 206 obligation to ensure that rates and practices are just and reasonable if we do nothing to change our own insufficient requirements. If there's nothing else.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's see. I guess we'll have the rebuttal now.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of brief points. Counsel for FERC has said that Central Iowa didn't involve planning, but if you look at the commission's own order, and this is a quote, it says, Central Iowa involved a situation where a power pool voluntarily agreed to joint planning and operation but allowed only some members to participate in planning, close quote. So it plainly involved planning. The problem here is, as the court said in Atlantic City, whether a mandate to order planning is a good idea or not, the commission was expressly denied that power. As the court said in Atlantic City, we're describing tight powers pools as entities that extensively coordinate their transmission planning. It said, quote, given the expressly voluntary nature of coordination under Section 202A, FERC could not mandate adoption of a coordination agreement. The only question here is whether an agreement to engage in joint planning is a coordination agreement. And the commission has said since the act was passed back in 1935 that it was. Congress doubled down on the voluntary nature of coordination when it passed an amendment to the Federal Power Act in PURPA in 1978 asking FERC to report on voluntary efforts at coordination. The commission has spent millions of...
Excuse me, Mr. Ryder. Is FERC misreading the statute in understanding that coordination to be the coordination in the transmission of power and as distinct from coordination of information and planning activities?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, the commission has spent years, you look back in the 1970s, it said that in the Public Service Company, the Indiana case, that Section 202A, its efforts, its ongoing efforts, it said, which have been going on for years, were to encourage coordinated long-range transmission planning. It described that as a cornerstone of its efforts under 202A. The commission has spent generations encouraging coordination. It's not toothless. It has plenty of power to encourage people to coordinate. It can offer incentives. It does so. It's made RTOs voluntary. It proposed regional transmission planning groups back in the early 1990s to encourage coordinated planning. But it crossed the line when it reached over from encouragement or inducement to coercion. And while it may be a great idea, and as the court talked about in MCI versus AT&T, the fact that a particular idea is a good idea but has been not denied the agency authority by Congress, the Congress only gives the agency limited powers, and they can't go beyond something, beyond what they're authorized by statute, simply because they think it's a good idea. That's what they've done in this case.
So the commission says, in effect, since we issued Order 890, the world has changed. That Edison Electric tells us about all this investment that's coming forth. We have the Brattle Report. We have these individual comments. And essentially, you're saying there's nothing the agency can do other than to issue press releases encouraging everybody to do better.
Not at all, Your Honor. They're not toothless. They can, as they did do, encourage the participation in RTOs. And to be an RTO, you have to agree to engage in coordinated planning. That's part of the criteria. You get to choose whether you participate in an RTO, but plenty of utilities have chosen to go that route. What they've done, though, is to say with whom you will coordinate and on what terms and to what extent you'll coordinate, powers that were expressly denied to the commission by Congress. In Section 202A, as this Court has interpreted the statute.
Right. So your whole argument on limitation rests on 202A?
No, not entirely. What I'm saying is if you look at 206, and I think if you go back to the Supreme Court's decision in the Mobile Sierra cases, they talked about on its face Section 206, was a provision in which the commission serves only in a reviewing function, because the whole scheme of the act was voluntary arrangements between utilities. The commission here has gone way beyond regulating the reasonableness of a practice by ordering utilities, deciding with whom they will coordinate and to what degree. Concepts that this Court expressly rejected when it affirmed the commission back in central Iowa and rejected the plea from the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission that the utilities should be ordered to engage in single system planning. Pretty much the same issue that's present here. Now, it may have been a good idea back in 1978, and it probably was still a good idea back in 78, and then that same year when Congress passed PURPA, they said, they went a little further. They said, we want reports on power pooling and how well utilities are voluntarily coordinating. And they even went one step further, but they doubled down on voluntariness. In Section 201A-1, they said that if utilities choose to voluntarily coordinate and a state stands in their way, they could come to FERC and ask for an exemption. But that underscores that the whole scheme Congress envisioned was that utilities would, in the exercise of their judgment and in consultation with state commissions and their consumers, that they would decide whether to proceed. And FERC could convince them. If the Order 1000 is vacated in its entirety, those utilities who have found that the process is too expensive and not worth the benefits can back out. Those who think it's a good idea can continue, and the commission can remain free to encourage those types of coordination activities that they think will advance the public interest. But, they can't cross the line from inducement to coercion, which is barred under the statute.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Tunnell?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, FERC did not give voluntary transmission planning a chance. Order 890, the ink wasn't even dry on Order 890 before FERC plunged into Order 1000. For my client, Southern Company, our transmission, our compliance filings to 890 were still pending before the commission when they issued the note for order 1000. So you can't say they gave the Order 890 voluntary processes a chance. And the lot of transmission investment, Your Honors, that's a non sequitur to what's going on here, because just because you have a lot of transmission investments going to occur does not mean that the current practices are unjust and unreasonable. From our perspective, we hope that FERC wouldn't be breaking what works. There's a lot of transmission investment has to be made. The current planning processes are robust. Our concern here and the evidence that we presented demonstrates that FERC is breaking a process that works.
Well, some might say they're not breaking it. They're building on it. And I guess I could use a little more concreteness about what the downside is. If you're working in a region where the voluntary planning process is highly functional, doesn't demand very much of you to comply with the very flexible and open-ended mandate of Order 1000 to have a planning process. And I mean, is there not room for a claim that the requirement that all stakeholders be included is what some of the incumbents are concerned about? I mean, so could you respond to those who might say you've been in a privileged position and there are outsiders who'd like to be heard and you don't want to hear from them?
Well, but Order 890 opened up our processes. I mean, that was the point of Order 890. Order 890 made our processes open and transparent. Now that's what Order 890 did. And again, FERC didn't give that a chance to work. It jumped straight into Order 1000.
FERC identified deficiencies in Order 890. So why continue to allow something that they already know isn't going to be effective?
Well, Order 890 was a self-contained package. I mean, it addressed what it said it was going to address. And
I know, but now FERC has identified deficiencies in that order.
Right, Your Honor, and the five deficiencies they asserted, we provided extensive evidence demonstrating that none of those deficiencies even apply to my client. Other petitioners also demonstrated a lot of evidence that it doesn't apply there as well. And going back to your point, Your Honor, this goes to another reason why this order is not reasonably tailored. Even though we have none of the deficiencies, we still have to comply with all of the order's requirements. And doing that, among other things, that's going to undermine our vertical integration. And this court has recognized that vertical integration affords benefits to customers, and FERC never even addresses that. FERC assumes the benefits of introducing competition, which, again, doesn't really make sense because this is a natural monopoly. But it assumes the competition you're going to get by bringing in all these independent companies that are going to break about vertical integration, but it never addresses the downside of that ledger. And so from a State Farm perspective, FERC has ignored a major ramification associated, a major problem with the order, and also violated its court's precedent in Tenneco.
When you say it never addressed it, I mean, it had the comments, and it said in effect, we've considered the comments, and on balance, we think that the benefits of vertical integration do not outweigh the benefits of the process of allowing all the stakeholders in, et cetera. I mean, that's consideration, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. They did no weighing of the benefits of vertical integration. All they said is that...
Well, they said efficiencies, experience, et cetera. I mean, they went through the qualities.
Your Honor, what they said is vertical integration may provide benefits. That's what they said. In Tenneco National Fuel, this court was very clear that vertical integration does afford benefits. So they never weighed it. And if you look at the Tenneco decision, Your Honor, In that case, FERC and the court did a weighing of the pluses and minuses of vertical integration of the requirements that FERC was imposing there. There is weighing. There has been no weighing. All that FERC says is, well, if vertical integration really does provide benefits, then you should be able to compete. But that doesn't address the issue. Again, here in the order itself, FERC is assuming benefits. I mean, if you look at the 217B4, whether or not the cost will exceed the benefits. FERC, when it points to benefits, all the benefits it has is about essentially breaking up vertical integration, about bringing in these TOs. So the order is assuming these benefits, but it never addresses the downside. For example, we brought forth evidence that vertical integration allows us to do quicker storm restoration, which is a major issue in the Southeast. We're subject to both hurricanes and tornadoes. We provided evidence that our vertical integration allowed us to restore our system, I believe it's in 12 days after Hurricane Katrina. And that was because of the benefit of vertical integration. If you move to this new model, that benefit will be lost.
Why would that benefit be lost? Yeah. If a planning process includes economic studies and exchange of information, and there's a persuasive case that the vertical integration is really a superior, efficient, and reliable way to deliver power, is it threatened by this problem?
Well, as a practical matter, transmission planning, it doesn't weigh operational or restoration issues. That's not what transmission planning does. I mean, transmission planning is looking at cost of projects, so it doesn't even look at the full panoply of the benefits that are afforded by vertical integration, Your Honor.
Couldn't it enter a process, I mean, isn't that open to you to design a process that does look at that?
That wouldn't be transmission planning. Again, and that goes to the whole point. I mean, we've got a process that works now. I mean, look at the DOE report. Says we've got a robust system, and it's largely due to our planning process. And so FERC is completely changing the paradigm, even though none of the deficiencies they asserted in the order even apply to us.
Transmission planning doesn't consider the reliability and efficiency of the end product?
It doesn't consider system restoration issues and O&M. I mean, a lot of the efficiencies of scale you have with transmission are on the O&M side and system restoration. And transmission planning doesn't address those kind of operational and restoration issues.
I think we're all surprised to hear that.
Right. Well, planning addresses the cost of facilities up front.
I understand, but the facilities for what purposes?
I mean, one of the big issues, and you guys are steeped in this much more full time, but, we've heard about reliability and the need for more robust transmission facilities precisely to enhance reliability in the kinds of events you talk about and service to customers. And so presumably, I thought that was sort of the backdrop of the whole project. But.
Well, again, it's changing the whole paradigm. I mean, when transmission is a natural monopoly. So in our footprint, we're building our transmission. So the system restoration and operational issues, that's not even an issue. I mean, we're going to be doing it. And so when you change the whole paradigm and break the vertical integration, you're moving to a new paradigm.
All right. I think we have your argument. Why don't we hear from Mr. Elliott? If he wishes. The generosity of the court.
I appreciate it. FERC essentially makes a Chevron 2 argument and said facilitates, that's pretty mushy. We've done that here. But facilitates, I mean, the dictionary definition is to make easier, to help bring about. I think it requires some affirmative action by FERC. And here they've taken no affirmative action because they've completely omitted this provision of the statute from public policy requirements.
All right. Thank you. All right. Now we'll turn to cost allocation.
Session 2, cost allocation. Mr. Bentley, for petitioners, Alabama Public Service Commission et al., arguing state sovereignty. Ms. Perry, for respondent, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Schneider, for petitioner, South Carolina Public Service Authority et al., arguing cost allocation. And Mr. Kennedy, for respondent, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
May it please the court, Section 201 of the Federal Power Act says that FERC regulation is only to extend to matters not subject to regulation by the states. In our brief, on pages 20 through 22, we listed numerous statutes that show that the states do regulate transmission planning.
Excuse me, what is your name?
Luke Bentley. Your Honor, maybe under Luther Bentley.
I have you. Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
Go right ahead. Excuse me.
In our brief, on pages 20 through 22, we listed numerous statutes that say that the states do regulate transmission planning. For one example, on page 20, we referred to a Florida statute that says that the Florida Public Service Commission is charged with the planning and the development of a coordinated energy power grid.
What do you do with, I mean, the Supreme Court in New York versus FERC said of the limitation, what you're calling the limitation in 201, it was just a policy statement. What we need to look to is we have this broad grant of authority to FERC to regulate electricity transmission and interstate commerce. That's the limit.
We recognize that 201 is a policy statement.
We're not talking about siting. We're not talking about construction, right? We're talking about planning.
But 201 is to be used as a guide to resolve any indefiniteness in the other sections of the statute. And our position is that, as we've heard this morning from the other petitioners, that 202 and 206 are not clear and that the Order 1000 is not based on clear jurisdictional authority from Congress. And our point is that if it's not clear, then under 201A, that some analysis to be done with how Order 1000 is affecting the states. And so as part of that analysis, we want to make clear that the states do regulate in this area, that the state commissions through statutes are involved in transmission planning that shapes transmission solutions. And as I said, we had a couple of pages in our brief that laid out these statutes, these state planning statutes, and our FERC did not address any of these statutes. I respectfully submit that they didn't address them because they cannot.
Is it your position that the planning that you do as a state will risk being in conflict with the planning that the regional planning bodies under Order 1000 will do?
You know, I think our position is more that that this order relegates the states to mere stakeholders in the planning process.
Well, in the process of planning for interstate transmission, maybe so. The states have a seat at the table and an important one for the reasons that you say. But the Federal Power Act gives the commission power only with respect to those matters which are not subject to regulation by the states, and the states clearly have authority over energy generation, local distribution, within state transmission and sales. But the interstate problems are, it's sort of con law 101 that they're a federal matter, and FERC is trying to do that in a relatively flexible way by requiring coordination to be developed by the stakeholders, the participants, rather than running the show itself. And it's always difficult to interface the different levels, the sovereign states and the national government, but I guess I'm having trouble understanding where you think this steps on your prerogatives.
Well, first I want to say that 201 sort of recognizes that the states do have a role in this process, and the line is not necessarily, interstate commerce. I mean, Congress is laid out in 201 that there's some things that are that electricity is interstate in nature, but in Connecticut Light and Power, Court recognized that even though it's interstate in nature, that Congress has said that the states are involved in some of that regulation. So that's to address your first point. And that to the point that this is stepping on state authority is that the states do have these planning processes, and Order 1000 has really rendered these meaningless, or at least relegated these to the states, the stakeholders in these processes, versus a position as a regulator.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see, we have Mrs. Perry.
Good morning. Lona Perry for the commission. The commission found that in issuing Order 1000, it did not intrude in any manner on state authority. And it specifically found that with respect to siting, with respect to construction, with respect to integrated resource planning, that the Order 1000 planning requirements did not interfere in any way with those state requirements. And the states are free to continue to plan and to continue to exercise their authority as they did before. The states are stakeholders in the regional planning process, which has to do with the regional cost allocations and the projects that are selected in that planning process, but that is no limitation on their ability to exercise their state prerogatives. and with regard to state planning. And frankly, any project, even picked in the regional process, that doesn't get the requisite state approvals for siting or construction or anything else doesn't get built. And in fact, the commission found that the planning requirements from the regional processes will actually be helpful to the states in their regional, in their state planning processes, because it gives them more options, more information, and more ways that they can look at solving their own integrated resource planning issues.
Thank you. How do you respond to Mr. Bentley's point that, you know, that they're also doing transmission planning. They're not just doing siting and permitting, and you know, and that they, this, in a sense, the federal process renders that, you know, trumps that, or is inconsistent with that.
It, the commission found that it doesn't conflict at all with that, Your Honor. And as a matter of fact, in Order 1000A at the Joint Appendix 374, paragraph 215 of the order, they have a discussion about how Order 1000 doesn't infringe on state integrated resource planning or in any way negate any state-level decisions about planning. The, again, the commission's finding was, and this is in 1000A at paragraph 190, JA 369, and also in paragraph 170 of that order, that this planning process that they're engaging in will actually be helpful to the state. It will just provide more information and more options to the states to consider in their own planning process, but it won't in any way interfere with their ability to conduct their own planning. And again, if the state doesn't issue, if the state doesn't approve of the project, if the state doesn't issue permits or anything else required for the construction of the project, it won't get built. And so there is no intrusion on the state's prerogatives with regard to what gets constructed in their state.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Schneider?
Good morning.
Yes,
good morning, Your Honors.
Jonathan
Schneider for petitioners on the cost allocation issue. I should begin with an apology. I know this court has been tortured over the years with court cost allocation cases, and so you have my sympathy in one sense, but not in another. To be honest, this is really not about cost allocation, as this court has understood that issue for the last 60 years, and as the commission has presented that issue to this court for the past 60 years. This case is instead about a funding mechanism for new transmission developers that the commission thinks would serve the system better than the existing process. Cost allocation historically has always involved the allocation by a utility, whether a standalone utility or an RTO, both defined as utilities under the Federal Power Act, as the Court recognizes, to its customers. And what we have here is the commission directing utilities to fund new transmission developers through a standalone mechanism that would provide them a, as the commission puts it, flows of funds in order to provide some form of benefits. The commission's pretty upfront about this. They say that the current structure creates a significant risk that transmission developers who have no identified group of customers from whom to recover their costs need funding. So that's the idea. It's not about cost allocation.
Even if we were to agree with you that something fundamentally different is happening now, how does it run afoul of 206?
Sure.
Isn't this a practice that's directly affecting rates?
Yeah,
it seems to be in the wheelhouse of 206.
On the face of 206, this court has been clear that that the commission is permitted to address existing practices. This is not an existing practice. The idea of funding brand new standalone startup entities because the commission thinks they would somehow provide benefits to the system is not an existing practice. Cost allocation by a utility to its customers is clearly an existing practice. If any of our clients allocate costs around their system, or an RTO routinely engages in that, and this court has heard many cases involving that subject, then that would be an existing practice the commission has the right to affect under 206. But this is a brand new practice, a brand new idea to fund these entities. They're not coming in with tariffs. Ostensibly, they're providing service. They're not coming in with tariffs, which raises another ball of wax for the commission. The commission well knows that the way utilities are are engaged with their customers is through a tariff. It says this at page 129 of its brief. It outlines the law regarding tariffs, and it acknowledges that the way utilities are paid is to file a tariff which represents an offer. And when the customer takes service, they have effectively acceptance of the offer. This is basically a contract, as the commission
acknowledges. Is cost allocation not part of the planning process? I mean, if we were to disagree with petitioners on the mandate issue, doesn't cost allocation fall with that? Why isn't it part of the planning process?
Cost allocation is certainly part of the planning process.
If we were to disagree with petitioners and think that FERC can mandate this planning process, why doesn't cost allocation come along with it?
Because the issues are severable. And the answer is that the planning process does not tell us whether we have to fund a given result. What the Commission adds to the planning process, and I recognize that there are new accoutrements for the planning process associated with this rule, but what the Commission adds and what's objectionable with respect to so-called cost allocation is that they add to this the funding mechanism. When projects are identified in this brand new planning process that are thought to be more efficient solutions, then the Commission directs the utilities, and they direct them to carry it out in their tariffs, to fund these new entities, to pay the money. Now, if the entities were to file tariffs with the Commission, if they were defined as public utilities, and we don't yet know whether they would be, but there's a good chance of that, and they filed tariffs with the Commission that the Commission approved and customers chose to take service, that would be perfectly consistent with the statute. Because the statute is, as one of your honors pointed out earlier, the statute is structured to respond to utility filings. And if these new entities are utilities, they should file tariffs and customers should take service from them, and then they will have agreed to pay their costs. But what the Commission does instead is it directs our clients, the utilities around the country, it directs them to include in their tariffs basically an obligation to fork over the money to these new transmission developers. That's not the kind of offer and acceptance that tariffs are designed to accomplish.
Have we not crossed that bridge in sustaining the cost causation principle in NARUC versus FERC?
The cost causation principle generally, of course, enables the Commission, facilitates decisions, enabling the Commission to allocate costs according to relative benefits. And with that general proposition, we have absolutely no quarrel. And on a given utility system, that's exactly how it should be done. The Court's heard many cases to that effect. The Midwestern ISO case in the Seventh Circuit, the ICC case.
So then, if you all agree with the general principle, how do you carve this out? Why isn't this just a specific application of that general principle?
Because the program here is not about a given utility planning and assessing costs to its customers. It's about a program designed to require utilities to pay other entities with whom they are not doing business. And that's very different from what the Commission has done in the past. They're very different. There have been
different. But again, statutory language that bars it?
Yes, absolutely. To begin with, Section 205 has been very plainly interpreted by the Supreme Court to indicate that the statute is designed to respond to utility filings. In the United Gas Pipeline case from 1956, going back nearly 60 years, the court said plainly that the statute is designed to enable the Commission to review filings that utilities make.
But that's one way that the Commission acts. I mean, this is another way that the Federal Power Act empowers the Commission to act through an order. And the fact that much is done through tariffs and filings doesn't mean that that's the only.
The Commission has, there are only two sections of the Federal Power Act in play here, Your Honor, Section 205 and 206. We know from the Supreme Court's discussion in United Gas Pipeline that this is not consistent with 205. Turning then to 206, which is the only leg of the stool left for the Commission, the critical question is two questions. One, whether it's an existing practice, right? And it clearly is not, for the reasons we've discussed. And second, whether it meets the Cal ISO test.
Practice is that there is no recognition of the beneficial effect that the utility experiences as a result of being part of this regional grid.
You'll pardon me, Your Honor, but that's not a practice. That's an observation. A practice would involve an activity in furtherance of utilities obligation.
Well, the activity is things aren't being built. Nobody knows who's going to end up paying for them. Yet we have this cost-benefit principle. The commission says, it's going to take the same approach here. And this court, I agree, it's not a direct holding, but we have certainly recognized this concept that FERC has of the utilities being beneficiaries.
Yes. Let me address this with 2 points. First, with all due respect, I do think that those are observations regarding the way in which the marketplace is working.
I understand, but the word customer is not in the statute. So we're in 206.
Yes, we're
in the practice that is of concern is the planning for the future construction of transmission facilities to meet this growing need, the changing sources, et cetera. All of the stuff we just talked about. And now the question is, how are these things going to be funded in this system we now have where Congress has directed the commission to divide the country up into regions?
Yes.
And we have these grids where it's this pool concept.
Yes.
And that's what the commission is looking at. So you benefit. So do the other utilities. And part of the planning process ought to be, everybody who's going to be affected ought to be aware of, if we go forward with this particular proposal, here are the economic consequences.
Yes, I have several responses, Your Honor, with a good deal packed into that question. First of all, although it's sort of tough love, our view, of course, is that the statute simply doesn't permit the commission to do things that they think are nice. It may
be. But you agree the statute doesn't refer to the word customer.
Does
not refer to the word customer.
Yes, but if you go back to the United Gas
Pipeline. You agree with me on that?
If you go back to the Mobile Sierra cases.
Do you agree with me on that?
Yes.
All right.
Pardon me. Yes, of course.
Well, you say of course. I mean, your whole argument is that the commission's authority is limited to the relationship of the utility to its direct customer with whom it has a contractual relationship.
Since 1956 and in all of the cases that have considered thereafter, the courts have said that contracts between utilities and customers are the linchpin for the obligation of a customer to pay a utility for service.
And, but you're not representing the customer here, are you?
Yes, absolutely.
So your obligation to pay now has to take into account the fact that the entity from which you're receiving service is benefiting from the pool and the reliability as a result of these grids.
Yes, to just make sure we're identifying the customer correctly, the utilities that we speak for are identified as the so-called beneficiaries, and the tariffs
are identified as what?
The beneficiaries in the commission's rule.
That's right.
Yes, and so we're in the shoes of the ostensible customer, and
you're benefiting because of the grid of which you're a part.
Yes, and the question is whether the commission has the statutory authority to impose a relationship between us and the service, this service provider.
Whether the cost should follow the benefit.
That's
the commission's approach.
A principle of economics, but not consistent with the structure of the statute. I do want to refer, Your Honor, also to the California ISO case, which is very much on point and important in your disposition of the matter, and responsive to Your Honor. In the Cal ISO case, the commission proposed to change the ISO's board. The board of directors, and the court thundered that this was well beyond the commission's authority, and the commission defended itself, arguing that it had an impact on rates, that this was a good thing, that it was a lousy board, and we had a better board in mind, and it would have an impact on rates. And the court said that this was closely connected to a parade of horribles that the court went on to list with respect to what the commission might do if it got away with the Cal ISO decision. And that included telling utility what a labor contract had to look like, signing a particular lease, with a real estate company, engaging any nature of services. The service that the utility is being told to take from these new entities is no different. It is a so-called benefit that ostensibly reduces their cost, but the commission is taking the utility in hand and directing it to do business with these entities, something structurally that's identical to what was before the court in the CalISO case.
Mr. Schneider, you mentioned that you're relying on the structure of the statute. Are you also relying on the word practice? Is it your position that the only practices that are subject to regulation under Section 206 are practices of customer-facing utilities?
In the CalISO case, and of course many cases precede it with respect to the definition of practices, the court was very clear that there is not, that the fact that there is some arguable nexus between a rate and a practice does not bring it within the commission's authority, that there has to be a close connection, and moreover.
So you are relying on the term practice, and you're saying there's not enough of a nexus between the non-customer-facing transmission providers to be encompassed under 206, is that right?
Yes.
And so you're at Chevron Step 1 or Chevron Step 2 or
really,
both?
In the CalISO case, the court plainly said that they were relying on Chevron 1.
I know. I'm asking you what you're relying on.
Absolutely Chevron 1, without a doubt, both because of the United Gas Pipeline plain decision under 205 and the fact that the commission cannot mandate relationships between entities, and second, because on the face of this statute, under 206, this is not an existing practice. There is no existing cost allocation or really funding mechanism. There is no mechanism that calls for utilities, the customers, to do business with someone, to engage a supplier, a particular supplier, which is exactly what was going on in the CalISO case. They're taking us in hand. They're telling the utility
the case involving the board.
Yes. Yes, and the parade of horribles that the court discussed included signing a particular lease, signing a labor agreement, doing business with someone. The commission is not powerless here. I do want to make that absolutely clear, and I see my time is up. The commission is not powerless. They have the authority if a utility is faced with certain options, transmission options, cleaning service options, to determine that utility was imprudent for not using those options. It absolutely has that authority. So the rate authority is quite a hammer. So I would not say the commission is incapable of accomplishing much of what it wants to do. It also has the authority for incentives. I know I have reserved some time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Kennedy on behalf of the commission. I guess I'll start where we left off with the statutory basis for the commission's action. There have been some suggestion in the briefing that the commission based its actions here on the lack of a specific prohibition in the Federal Power Act, but that's absolutely not the case. What the commission explained throughout Order 1000 and Order 1000A is that its cost allocation reforms were based on its statutory authority under Section 206 of the Federal Power Act. Now, as we've been discussing today, Section 206 grants the commission the authority to remedy any practice that's found to be unjust and unreasonable. Now, one of the predicates is this a practice? And as this court has recognized in City of Cleveland and a number of other cases, that's a pretty amorphous term that Congress has put there, and it's the commission enjoys considerable discretion in defining what practices fall within the ambit of Section 206. And here, I think there's a serious dispute that we're close to the line. As the commission explained in Order 1000A, the whole purpose of these cost allocation methodologies is to identify who are the beneficiaries of this facility and therefore to whom the initial construction costs can be.
But petitioners have sounded a theme consistently, and I haven't heard a response to it yet. Maybe it was made and I just didn't catch it, that there's a significant distinction between inducement and coercion. And that's where the line has been crossed here. It's one thing for FERC to induce stakeholders to participate. It's quite another to create new relationships through coercion. Could you?
Well, I think we're getting a bit beyond whether this is a practice, but I think the fundamental question, I wrote down some quotes that what the commission is doing here is imposing a relationship. No, what the cost causation, what the general principle the commission directed the regions to adopt with respect to cost allocation is simply beneficiary pays. And this court and numerous others have found that that is what cost causation means, and cost causation
without distinction, without any limitation on inducement as opposed to coercion. Because that's the point, right? The petitioners don't disagree with the notion that beneficiaries pay, but is it a beneficiary who's already in the existing relationship, or are we going to lasso somebody else in and make them?
Well, what the commission did essentially is, in looking at, as Judge Rogers described, kind of the state of play we're looking at now with regions, interconnected grids, and this looming need for new authority, we're going to take the cost causation principle, longstanding, well-established, and we're going to apply it in this new world with basically two animating principles. One, service is going to be defined by grid operations. When you place electricity into an interconnected grid, it's just a scientific fact that you are affecting all those facilities and you are, in some sense, using all those facilities. The Supreme Court recognized this in New York versus FERC, that any transmission on an interconnected grid is interstate, and that when you put energy into the grid, it becomes part of a vast pool, undifferentiated, and all the components of that grid are affected by the transmission. 20 years ago, in the Northern States case, this court approved the commission's view that all the components that make up a transmission grid really are part of the same system. They operate as a single system, I believe is the word. And the court recognized that has a strong basis in the laws of physics and in the way in which electricity works. So what the commission is doing is saying you are using a facility when you transmit electricity on a grid. You are making use of that facility. So we're not imposing a relationship. We're recognizing the relationship that exists.
Well, but they're saying you're imposing it because we're talking about funding of facilities that don't yet exist, and they're saying we're happy with the position we're in. We're actually close to the customers, and we can file rates that recover our costs, whereas those wind farms out there are not close to the customers, and you're proposing to bring them onto our grid, and therefore you're forcing us to engage in a relationship with them, and frankly, and requiring us to pay part of the cost of doing that, and we don't want any part of it. So it's not that they're already there. They're saying don't make us be venture capitalists on that one.
Well, and that's why the commission acted sort of as a rule and proposed it, made this general.
Something new, isn't it? I mean, something new has happened with this. This is a shift.
Well, I don't think it is, Your Honor. I mean, as the commission found, there are existing Order 890 required cost allocation methodologies to be developed. And in response to that, as the commission went through the orders, outside of the footprint of RTOs, generally, the way the region responded to that was with participant funding agreements, where basically the cost of a new facility initially are only going to be allocated to people who raise their hand and say, I want to participate. And as the commission explained in its orders, that leads to free rider problems, where essentially a project's on the table and everyone's around looking at it and saying, you know, I do like that, but I think my neighbor likes it a little more. Maybe he'll step up to the plate and I can just stand back and reap the windfall while they take the risk in funding the initial construction. Inside the RTOs, the commission acknowledged that there had been work in developing methodologies. Some of them had processes in place to identify the beneficiaries, but the process, particularly for large-scale projects, has been very contentious. You see that in the Seventh Circuit with the various ICC decisions. And no one had really developed, although there had been cost allocation methodologies developed, none of them really addressed what are we going to do about interregional facilities, which are becoming a bigger concern. So there was an existing practice that the commission did there. Certainly, there's a change. We found those practices unjust and unreasonable for the orders recounted, for the reasons recounted in the orders, that they've led to the possibility, given all the new transmission that's going to be coming online, the commission believed that the existing practices may lead to unjustness.
What's new then? What's the new step that's been taken?
Well, essentially, it's requiring, and it's not an earth-shattering notion, it's requiring the existing allocation methodologies to be revised to reflect at a baseline level the longstanding cost causation principle.
But isn't that capturing a new group of players that weren't in the equation before?
In some sense, it's certainly opening up the possibility that people will be allocated costs initially that wouldn't be the case previously. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's prohibited by the Federal Power Act. I mean, this is a practice affecting rates, and the Commission's remedy is basically to announce a principle that you have to develop methodologies that we're not telling them what methodologies to use, how to do it, just generally.
But you're capturing a new group of people who have to pony up money, who didn't have to before. Right?
Potentially. I mean, they are involved in the right. in the they had been and are still involved in the planning process.
But now they're going to have to pay.
Maybe if they are beneficiaries, and the commission acknowledged that the commission recognized that this is necessary, but it's also required by the law. I mean, we're taking cost causation and just extending it to its reasonable conclusion.
Why doesn't this run afoul of Fort Pierce Utilities? You know, we have said that you don't have power to approve joint rates where two systems are not already operating as a whole. And, you know, and the petitioners are relying on that. Why isn't this just like a joint rate?
Well, just one point initially and technically. What I believe in Fort Pierce, really the commission's declined. I don't think the court held the commission didn't have authority to require joint rates. It was just that they approved the commission's decision not to do it in that instance. This is not joint rates because the rates we're essentially talking about here are the rates for the new facility that's being built. We're just talking about how the capital costs of that facility are going to be allocated. So joint rates really aren't implicated by that concern. I mean, I mentioned there were two.
Say that once more, if you would, please.
Well, really, all we're talking about allocating is the costs of the new facilities that are being built to the extent mm-hmm. they are selected in the regional plan. We're not requiring that owner to then negotiate a joint rate with anyone else. I mean, really, we're just requiring them. We're just setting up a process to establish the initial rates, essentially, for the construction costs. Identifying.
But back to Judge Griffith's question, just so I'm clear here, the new aspect of this is not the principle of cost causation, but the fact that. If I can just carry this through, if you have a regional planning process and they decide to build new facility X, then existing transmission providers know that they are going to have to, according to whatever formula the region develops, pay a percentage of the cost of that new facility. So, if facility X is approved by the state authorities and whoever's going to build it is looking for the funding and has to assure the state authorities that this can be funded, financed, etc., it's going to list those other entities in whatever percentage the method adopted by the regional planning group has determined. Isn't that right?
What a list. But I mean, to be clear, the commission has not gotten into
it. The on-the-ground effect of this. I mean, council says you're forcing us to pay for somebody we don't have any contractual relationship with. And so Judge Griffith's question, as I understood it, is, well, let me just ask it my way. As I understood the point was that the principle is old and well-established, so is this court's acknowledgement of grid relationships and the cost-beneficiary relationship. So what's new here before the court?
Well, it's kind of putting it at the start of the process. I mean, rather than waiting. I mean, the problem is, as the commission explained, these are massively expensive projects, and if you don't have a source of, if you can't assure your lenders that I'm going to get this money back somehow, these aren't going to get built. So rather than sorting all this out after the fact, when these projects wouldn't get built, they're too expensive to do it after the fact, we're going to modify your existing practices to modify your methodologies to basically move the cost causation principle to front, make it ex ante. So a developer will have, I mean, and there's two reasons for it. One, whoever is going to build the project will have some assurance that they're going to get some money at the end of the day. And B, also, that the people who are part of the planning process, the potential beneficiaries and other stakeholders, will understand what this project brings to the table. When the allocation comes, they'll have they'll have data showing why they benefit from this project. There's various means for them to challenge that. It's not as if, as been suggested, that a project's going to get built up in the western quadrant of a region and all of a sudden you're going to get a bill at your door down in the southern quadrant. I mean, there's a lot of process built in to ensure that the beneficiaries understand why they were why they benefit from this process, and if they disagree with either the methodology preparing it in the first instance, they have the remedies. If they disagree with their designation as a beneficiary, there's process for them to challenge that. I mean, really, what the commission is saying: A, we're not creating customer relations. We're recognizing, based on grid operations, what's really happening here, and extending the cost causation principle to reflect the realities of grid operation, and really not allowing people to use pre-existing contractual relationships really as a shield to prevent them from bearing their fair share of the cost that of a facility that is determined to give them benefits.
And they only pay when that power is actually on the grid. They're not paying in advance, are they?
Well, I mean, the commission, and I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how this will actually work in practice. I mean, the commission left off the table, decided not to address in this order how really cost recovery would work, because there's a myriad of different entities out there as a result of the varying states of deregulation across the nation, all the different regions, and the way people have chosen to get together. So there's a lot of different ways that could be done. So I don't think there's a uniform answer, and it's I'm not certain I have a definitive answer on whether it would be beforehand or whether it would be rolled in. I think it would, in existing ISOs that have similar processes, it's just rolled into the cost of the new facility is placed into the rate base for the ISO. And then your payment is based on your usage. So, yes, it's a long way of saying.
And I think we've asked this question to one of your colleagues before, but if FERC has the authority to do this, can you help us with a limiting principle, what FERC can't do under Section 206?
Well, I think the...
Other than CalISO.
Well, right. I mean, we see that all the time, and it's so far out of bounds now that we understand that that's not really an issue. I mean, I think there is, and this is an issue the commission grapples with, to be perfectly honest, and it comes up more and more. I mean, there has to be, well, obviously the statute tells us it must be an existing practice, and it has to have a direct relationship to rates. The further, and I know this is not a very helpful answer, but obviously the further away you get from that, the more the bounds of the commission's discretion become stretched a little more and more. I don't think it's an issue here, because again, as the commission explained, there really could not be a more direct tie to rates.
So you're in Chevron. You're in Chevron too.
I know it when I see it. But
go there. Your colleague said, clearly Chevron step one, and you think you're in Chevron step two.
Well, I think clearly. I think with respect to whether practice is vague or ambiguous, I think it's been acknowledged generally that it's not a very precise term, but I think that this is clearly a practice that affects rates.
Is there a limit on the interregional application of cost allocation? I mean, you've chosen one here, but is FERC's position that you haven't reached the outer limit of your power there?
Well, I mean, the Commission hasn't spoken to that really. I mean, it did for practical reasons,
right,
policy reasons, not extended here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, based upon the theories of the Commission's that the Commission has adopted, that these are interconnected grids, that the facilities affect everything. I mean, it's certainly a
positive. That's pretty sweeping power. That's what you're getting at.
Well, I mean,
there's potential to be quite sweeping.
That's the subject matter of the jurisdiction. The powers are, again, defined by the Act, so praxis with respect to those. Whether it could as a matter of theory, I think it's possible given what the Commission has announced here, but it certainly doesn't do so here.
Could I just ask you your answer about some ISOs now and the rolling in of the rate base for the ISO? Where can I find that in the record?
I'm sorry?
Where can I find that in the record? The ISO practice.
Well, I know it is.
Or is there a case out there that describes it?
Well, I think the Illinois Commerce Commission case from the Seventh Circuit addressed their methodology. I don't know, sitting here today, whether those cases get to the sort of end of the line step, how the bills are sent out.
Well, to the extent we're talking about a practice, and counsel's saying you can only deal with existing practices, I know you don't take that position, and City of Cleveland suggests you do have more leeway than that, but if there is an existing practice out there that is doing it not ex ante but at the back end, and it's not working the way that FERC has determined is necessary for all the reasons we've been through, then that's another bow, as it were, in the Commission's argument, isn't it?
Well, no, exactly. I mean, there are – this is why I would believe it is an existing practice, because there are planning processes out there, mm-hmm. That some of which come close to meeting all the guidelines set forth in Order 1000, but others that fall well short.
I guess both the argument about existing practice and the argument about forcing them to engage with entities that they're not voluntarily contracting with sort of get to a similar problem. And that's where I know this is different from the joint rate, but it seems like the principle in the joint rate case was that you can't take two systems and make them be treated as one. And here I think they're saying, you know, those that are not yet part of our grid, you're kind of ex ante making us acknowledge them as, you know, part of us for purposes of rolling their costs into the rate. And so why, you know, at a more sort of fundamental level, why is that not in tension with the Fort Pierce?
Well, the joint rate issue is really a matter of cost recovery, and it's a remedy available to the Commission to address circumstances where there's rate pancaking, where you're transmitting across various systems and the charges stack up, and maybe for whatever reason it becomes an unreasonable rate. So to the extent the Commission recognizes, unification in the operation of those systems, it may, has the discretion to impose a joint rate. I mean, that's really what the joint rate doctrine in those cases deal with. I mean, it's sort of a consumer or a user remedy. It's not so much applicable, and it's really a cost recovery issue rather than allocation. And the Commission grappled with this as well, its application to the process we're dealing with here.
And forgive me, the distinction between cost recovery and cost allocation as you're using them?
Well, the cost allocation is identifying who the beneficiaries are and their slice of the pie. Mm-hmm. Cost recovery is really how are we going to go about sending out the bills and getting in the money. There's a variety of ways to collect on that. And the Commission declined to get into an Order 1000.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Schneider, do you want minutes?
Thank you. Several points. First, with respect to whether there are existing practices on which the Commission might reasonably build under Section 206, Your Honor, Judge Rogers points to the existing independent system operator allocation mechanisms and asks whether we might not build on that in order to do what we're doing here. This case is not about allocation within an ISO. The principles regarding allocation within the ISO are fairly consistent with what the Commission has done here. This is not about that. It's rather about grids in which there either are no ISOs or the allocation of costs between ISOs. So we do not have that existing practice to build on. I want to address briefly.
Let me just be very clear.
Yes.
You acknowledge that these practices exist
in the
ISOs.
Not in the Southeast, not in the Northwest.
But in the ISOs.
Yes, within the ISOs they do.
And you're saying certain regions do not follow them.
Yes. Major portions of the country are not within an ISO, and the allocation mechanism the Commission proposes would call for funding outside any of the utility boundaries. Mm-hmm. If there were ISOs in those regions, and perhaps the Commission would like to see that, then the allocation would work contractually. You would have an ISO allocating cost around a grid. But that's not what's before the court. This rule principally applies to non-ISO regions, mm-hmm. where there are no existing relationships between the utility provider, which would have been the ISO, and the customer. Briefly, with respect to Fort Pierce.
And I know that because...
I apologize.
Where in the record can we find support for what you just said about this principally applying to the non-ISO circumstances?
I will supply a citation for it, Your Honor. Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have a quick citation with me. But it's certainly why our clients are here, because it applies to us. And within the ISOs, the cost allocation is already being done within the ISOs.
You're representing the South Carolina Public Service Authority, et al.
Et al. Large Public Power Council as well, and speaking for the other petitioners as well. For the most part, they are outside ISOs.
For the most part.
Yes. There isn't.
Not all.
No, but there is the Commission.
Well, we have to be clear here. You're making a very definitive statement.
Yes.
And I say I may have missed it.
No.
But I didn't. I catch that, and that's why I'm just trying to pin this down.
Of course. Yes, the application of this rule is twofold, and the contract problem that we've addressed applies in two situations. One, in a non-ISO region where there are no relationships in play, and two, between ISOs, where the Commission indicates that costs may be allocated between the ISOs so long as there is stakeholder agreement, mm-hmm. right? Now, in any given ISO, the stakeholders may choose to opt for the plan, and others may be voted down. And so there is an application there, somewhat limited, but there is an application there. So in those two situations, the cost allocation issue we're discussing today does not have application within the ISO.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, so now part three, right of first refusal.
Issue three, right of first refusal. Mr. Shepard for Petitioners Public Service Electric and Gas Company, et al., Ms. Perry for Respondent, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and Mr. Engelman for Interveners for LS Power Transmission, LLC, et al.
Good morning.
I was about to note the clock was off. Thank you. Good morning. And may it please the court. The so-called non-incumbent reforms in Order Number 1000 are radical mandates that Congress did not authorize FERC to impose. The Federal Power Act does not authorize FERC to regulate the construction of transmission facilities, much less to require the existing utilities allow putative competitors to build additions to their existing networks with their costs covered by the utility's customers. Nor is this sort of radical change that an agency suddenly discovers needs to be made on a generic basis without some sort of prodding from Congress. Even if FERC had authority to regulate the construction of transmission lines, and I reiterate again that it does not, FERC's mandates are arbitrary and capricious because they're a solution in search of a problem. There is no evidence that transmission planners declined to consider reasonable transmission reasonable transmission project alternatives that were proposed to them. Order 890 required that. And there was certainly no evidence that in order to get better ideas, FERC had to require that utilities allow competitors to come into existing utilities' territories and charge their customers cost-based rates for that invasion. FERC's theory is that competition will naturally produce these better ideas, but the reason that that's a non sequitur here, because what FERC is proposing is not competition, it's predation. In order to take action under FPA Section 206, you have to show that the entities involved are similarly situated. These entities are not similarly situated, and what separates them is the existence on the one hand of an obligation and the absence of an obligation on the other. The utility, when it's given its state franchise, accepts both the responsibility to serve all of its customers and the right to serve those customers. And the two things go hand in hand. It's a regulatory compact that's existed since even before the Federal Power Act existed. So I believe that this case can, and I'm happy to discuss the FPA Section 206 implications, but I'd like to first talk about the lack of statutory jurisdiction, because as in CAISO, I think this case can and should be decided purely at Chevron Step 1 because of the lack of an affirmative authorization from Congress to regulate in this space. The Natural Gas Act and the Federal Power Act are very different in one key respect. Section 7 of the Natural Gas Act expressly authorizes FERC to determine who builds natural gas pipelines, where they are built, how they are built, what the rate of return will be. There's absolutely nothing like that in the Federal Power Act. There's a good historical reason for that. When they enacted the Natural Gas Act, they knew they were going to have to pull natural gas from far-flung places up to major consumer centers, and transmission was much more localized back when the Federal Power Act was passed. There have been many attempts to come and try to gain this authority, and they've been rebuffed by Congress every time. And we don't have to look very far into the past to figure out what it is FERC may and may not do, because in 2005, in the Energy Policy Act 2005, we get a number of new additions to the Federal Power Act. In particular, I'd like to focus your attention on FPA Section 215, subsection I. It's codified at 824O paren I, and also Section 216, which is 824P. I don't know how Congress can be more explicit in FPA Section 215 to say the FPA, or this act, does not authorize the Commission to order the construction of additional transmission capacity. That's pretty clear. The new Section 216, codified at 824P, is extremely narrow in what it allows FERC to do by way of transmission backstop authority. First, a state and the Department of Energy have to get together and they have to decide that they want to create a national interest electric transmission corridor. And they have to collaborate. The Ninth Circuit has already thrown out the existence in the California Wilderness Coalition case 2 years ago, has already thrown out the idea that you can even create an NIETC without effective collaboration with the states. And then and only then, if a transmission project is proposed within that zone and the state, for some weird reason, chooses to do absolutely nothing, it can affirm, it can deny. Those things are all clear. This is the Fourth Circuit's decision in Piedmont, 2009. Only in the bizarre instance where a state agrees to an NIETC and then decides to do absolutely nothing, and through laches, FERC can sweep in and take this backstop authority. There is no reason for 824P to exist. There is no reason for 824OI to exist. And there is no reason even for Section 7 of the Natural Gas Act to exist if FERC can employ its authority under FPA Section 206 to accomplish its objective here. Now, why do I say that? Because the language in FPA Section 206 is exactly the same as Natural Gas Act Section 5.
But, of course, FERC says it's not making any decision whatsoever about what or who gets to do construction.
Well, I don't think that the second part of that can be regarded as true, because what they are saying is that we would like these people to have a seat at the table. There are a couple of things that are terribly wrong with FERC's theory.
But you agree, don't you? I mean, that it's not saying that the ABC Corporation is to build, you know, the first.
ABC Corporation goes into an RTO planning process.
Right.
They talk to their state.
Right.
They, at the conclusion of a year-long, usually, planning process, there will be a vote by an RTO board.
Right.
And that will create a project. That project will need to be funded.
Maybe,
then you have
or maybe not.
FERC isn't
getting into any of that.
That is true. FERC is not mandating that any particular thing be built. They have declared that that is the case. What they have done, however, is they've said These putative transmission developers, these potential competitors of yours, they have to be given a seat at the table. Now, that already happened in Order 890, and I don't need to, I don't think, rehash the discussion of earlier today, that the ink was not dry, as we've said several times, on Order 890 before FERC decided to move ahead with Order Number 1000.
Let me ask you about that, Mr. Shepard. You say that it already happened in Order 890, and then there's Order 1000, and then there's the rehearing order. Can you say that FERC expanded the scope of the right of first refusal and the rehearing order? Can you explain more fully what was expanded?
I'm not sure I know which argument you're talking about, ma'am.
Well, in your brief, you argued that FERC went beyond, I think it's in 1000A, what it had done in 1000, that it expanded the right of first refusal.
That was an argument that was raised largely by MISO about the way that some things are structured. FERC has said it's going to handle those in compliance, and in our reply brief, we said, all right, we'll take them at their word to handle it in compliance.
It's gone.
That's there along with the Mobile Sierra argument. You should expect to see a Mobile Sierra case. It's part of the reason why the FPA Section 206 argument here is so important. We're having a plain vanilla FPA Section 206 argument here. We have these contracts. We entered into RTOs. We said when we entered these agreements we were going to limit ourselves in certain ways. The Mobile Sierra dispute is FPA Section 206 on steroids in terms of the level of showing that FERC is required to modify our abrogated contract.
Do your contracts not contain clauses that would bring them within Mobile Sierra?
Oh, they do. They do. Yes. I mean, there are some where it is explicit, and there are some where it is implicit. But the rule under Mobile Sierra is also very, very clear that if a contract is silent about whether or not Mobile Sierra applies, it applies. In fact, it was this court in Texaco and then again in Appalachian that said that. So the rule is now unmistakably clear that the absence of any statement without any language to the contrary, it is unmistakably clear that Mobile Sierra applies.
So as far as you're aware, there are no petitioners in this case who are parties to contracts that contain rights of first refusal but that don't contain clauses that would bring their contracts within the ambit.
I'm not aware of any. I mean, I know deeply about the PJM process. I know about the ICE New England process. I know about the MISO process. I don't claim any particular expertise about the SPP contract, although in mooting this, I did ask the folks at SPP, you know, what do your provisions look like this? And I got no negative answers. Okay. But that is a whole other round of fighting that is going to come before this court, and it'll also be under the commission's reimagining of the Mobile Sierra doctrine on remand from NRG Power Marketing. There is a whole new way that they look at how that doctrine exists. We tried to litigate that in New England Power Generators Association versus FERC, but FERC very cleverly decided that it was going to let us have Mobile Sierra review anyway. So that they could avoid us having any standing in that case. So you're going to get to decide some very interesting things in the not-distant future.
Well, FERC has decided to defer the Mobile Sierra consideration to adjudication,
yes.
And I wonder if...
And they've rejected it in all the compliance filings, using boilerplate language, Your Honor, that imports the same arguments I was just referring to and that were presented in the NEPCA case. Basically, their view is...
Excuse me, Mr. Shepard. I wonder if there's any... issue with whether you have standing at this point, given that the Mobile Sierra considerations may well be dealt with, or if it's unripe.
Oh, yeah,
really. I suppose the better way of putting it is whether the issue is unripe because you've yet to hear from FERC on its case-by-case analysis of the Mobile Sierra
issue.
Yes,
we have. I don't think that there's any question that this case is ripe now. The Mobile Sierra discussion is about the level of showing that we were required to overturn the rights, but as things stand now, this is an affirmative command. It sets a legal standard.
The issue as to whether the agency has authority to require the elimination of federal rights of first refusal
is before you now.
Is the issue you want to argue as a matter of statutory authority? And that issue, you say, you have standing for and is right.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Right. We don't think they can be in this space at all. And we are already injured because the command is already present. And unless this court reverses FERC's orders, we still have to live in an Order Number 1000 world. Planning is going on right now, assuming that Order Number 1000 is in effect.
Well, the rehearing order says very clearly
that until FERC makes the Mobile Sierra determination, you don't have to strike anything from your term.
Well, that would be in stark conflict with an argument we just had last January 7th.
Where I don't know what you argued, I'm talking about what the commission in, is it 1000B?
Right.
Said on this very issue.
And what I'm trying to tell Your Honor now is that FERC has already told us that we need to plan with Order Number 1000 in mind. They've already given PJM, for example, an effective
date. That's because it's already ruled that PJM's agreement and the two others do not have rights that are protected under Mobile Sierra.
There are more than just two RTOs where that matters, but yes,
they're ruled. The brief at page 34 cites three instances in which FERC has already ruled.
Yes.
So that you do have to go forward in those three instances.
Yes, which I think establishes our standing. I'm not understanding if you're asking, are you trying to suggest we're not injured yet as well, Your Honor?
Well, I'm just trying to understand what you have standing to raise now.
Ah. Well, I think clearly there's been an assertion of statutory authority. That's point blank. There is also the question of whether or not we have been injured by the fact that we have to live with planning parameters that are indeed quite costly until such time as this court happens to overturn them.
But under the rehearing order, that's only true because FERC has already acted to say that you don't have the protection of Mobile Sierra?
No, I think that they were going to tell us that we had to do this anyway. And also, whenever we're talking about the contracts, we're talking about arguments that are limited to RTOs. The notion that FERC, that the non-incumbent reforms, which, and it's a misnomer to call them rights of first refusal. They're only properly thought of as rights of first refusal if you're in an RTO and you bargained about how you were going to set up your construction rights. You're required to let these people in the door, and you're also required to create a cost-based funding mechanism for them. That is not going to change based on Mobile Sierra arguments or not Mobile Sierra arguments. We've had a lot of discussion today about Southern Company's particular status. They don't have a contractual right of first refusal because the state statute doesn't even contemplate the idea that someone else is going to come in and build in their areas. There's no reason for them to have a contract. They have no Mobile Sierra defense to either non-incumbent reforms. And this issue obviously matters to them. That's why they're on the brief. They're told they have to let these other people come into their planning functions and that they're going to have to offer them the opportunity for cost-based rates, apparently in order to induce good ideas. So unless Your Honors need to pursue this question about injury further, I'd like to spend at least some time talking about California.
Well, you're out of time almost, so let's focus.
I'd like to get to the question of FPA Section 206 and CAISO. I mean, this is a really important part of the case here. I've seen some body language from the bench and also from FERC that, oh, well, CAISO, that was about governance. And, geez, that's just super attenuated. I don't think that analysis really stands. CAISO says determining who sits on the board, and after all, these are the guys who actually approve, that they're the thumbs up, thumbs down people on the projects at all, that's somehow more attenuated than deciding who gets to sit at the table and argue for a particular transmission construction idea. That doesn't hold any weight at all. That's like saying a rule about how we're going to select judges is more attenuated than a rule that decides how we're going to pick attorneys. When California ISO decided that it wanted to have a state-appointed board, those are people who make the decisions about whether things are going to be built or not built. And there's nothing about Order Number 1000 in mandating that other people are going to show up that's going to make those people smarter or in any way improve the system. Now, I see that my time is fled.
All right, we'll
fled.
Give you some time on rebuttal. All right, counsel for FERC.
With regard to the statutory justification for the right of first refusal, there is the same statutory justification, frankly, that goes for the rest of the planning as well, which is that it's a direct effect on rates when you limit the options that can possibly be brought forward for solutions for more cost-effective or more efficient projects. And there is also, in addition to that, the separate justification that it's unduly discriminatory to preclude the non-incumbent developers from being able to participate in the process and have the ability to at least put forward proposals for consideration in the regional process. And that deprives them of the opportunity to recover or to at least have the option to recover cost-based rates and a regional cost allocation, and is therefore also directly connected to rates in that manner.
So you're assuming that if the right of first refusal remained, that they wouldn't even new developers wouldn't even participate? Because those are two separate issues, no?
Your Honor, if the right of first refusal remains, the point is that all they are allowed to do is to participate as merchants, which the petitioner repeatedly says is fine. But the problem with being a merchant developer is that they're entirely at risk for the cost of the project, and it's not at all comparable to being able to build a cost of service project. And so this is a question of allowing them to participate on an even basis with the incumbent developers in being able to propose cost of service projects in the regional plan for purposes of regional cost allocation.
And what about their concerns that that's going to affect their reliability? They have obligations to ratepayers, and having newbies come in is going to put that at jeopardy.
Several responses to that, Your Honor. In the first place, with regard to them being newbies, I would also point out that the non-incumbents that we're talking about, not only they include third parties, but those can also be third parties such as the intervener here who has experience and has developed a number of projects. It's not necessarily that you're talking about somebody who is brand new to the process. And it can also include public utilities themselves, the incumbents themselves, to the extent that they build outside of their service territory. They are also, by definition, a non-incumbent under these reforms. And the definition is at paragraph 225 of Order 1000 of non-incumbent. But the other thing is the Commission found expressly that there was no reason to expect that that they put in place a number of reforms in Order 1000A in Order 1000 and 1000A to ensure that they would be able to meet their service and reliability obligations. That includes first of all, they preserved what Mr. Shepherd was referring to as the traditional right to build in your service territory. They retained a right of first refusal to build in their service territory so long as the costs are allocated to their customers and not allocated regionally to customers elsewhere. There is the reevaluation requirement, which requires that the public utilities in the region keep an eye on what is going on with the non-incumbent's development to make sure that there are no problems, and if there are, that they have the ability to go to withdraw the project from the plan and go back and reevaluate. They also have the qualification criteria. The Commission made sure that they had to make sure that the non-incumbent had the technical expertise and the financial resources to build the project and to reliably build the project. And given all of these processes, the Commission made the finding that there was no reason to expect that non-incumbents would perform any worse than current incumbents do with respect to delays, abandonment, reliability kinds of issues. And also that if the process was followed, the incumbents should be able to meet their reliability needs. And so the Commission recognized that they have service and reliability obligations as incumbents, but the Commission found that those obligations didn't justify retaining a right of first refusal, excluding third parties from participating in the regional process.
Could I ask a question about Section 215?
Yes, Your Honor.
Under Order 1000, is an incumbent required to submit a mitigation plan before there is a determination that there's been a violation of a reliability standard?
Your Honor, the commission actually clarified that statement in Order 1000A to make it clear that because they got, in response to Order 1000, concern from people that they were in some way expanding or changing the reliability right. requirements under 215. And in Order 1000A, the commission specifically addressed that, and you can see this in your joint appendix at page 426. In paragraph 480 and 483, the commission specifically said that it was affirming with clarifications the statement in Order 1000, and in 483 they made plain that the commission did not create new or modify existing NERC reliability okay. standards. And so
I understand that language, but I'm clear in my mind I don't understand the scope or limit of 215. In other words, FERC says these are requirements that we are saying have to be part of a tariff, correct?
No, Your Honor. And actually, in our brief at page 86, we pointed to the California ISO case on compliance as an illustration of this point. What the commission is saying in 1000A, the commission was saying that we are not imposing any new requirements. You do what you are required to do already under the NERC requirements. And they discuss specifically the operational requirements in paragraph 478 and the requirements to monitor and to file corrective plans in paragraph 479.
As I understand it, the argument, I just need to be clear on this, all right? The argument is that under the reliability standards in 215, you only have to file a mitigation plan after there's been a determination of a violation of a reliability standard. Now, under the order, you will have to develop a mitigation plan before there is a determination of a violation of a reliability standard.
No, Your Honor, that's what they were trying to clarify in Order 1000A.
I know, and where do they say that you don't have to file that?
What they say in Order 1000A, if you look at paragraph 480, what they say in Order 1000A, paragraph 480, I'm sorry, it's 426 of your joint appendix.
All right, I'm with you.
It's paragraph 480, and they talk about there they clarify the language to say that you submit a mitigation plan if there has been a violation identified to a penalty for a violation of a NERC standard. And that's why the commission was explaining in paragraph 483 that they were making clear that they aren't requiring anything that isn't already required in the FERC reliability standards. They were making, because there was that issue, because of the way it was phrased in Order 1000, and that's what prompted this discussion, was to point out that the reliability standards, that the commission is only requiring compliance with the reliability standards. And if you look at that.
So that means that the provision in the tariff about a mitigation plan only kicks into effect after there has been a determination of a reliability standard violation?
Well, see, this is the point, Your Honor, is that there is no, the tariff provision just goes to the reevaluation requirement is a tariff provision, and that's just the requirement that the public utilities monitor what's going on with the non-incumbent construction. But if you look at that California ISO case that we cited at page 86, it's 143-61-059, and it's paragraph 269. You will see there that the commission, California ISO, proposed a tariff provision that specifically addressed the when to file a mitigation report. And the commission struck it from the tariff, saying you file mitigation reports in compliance with NERC standards, and there is no separate tariff requirement to file mitigation reports. There's nothing different than what NERC requires. So we don't put this in the tariff. You're subject to the NERC requirements, and that's what you adhere to.
Thank you.
And so they wanted to make clear that there is no separate mitigation report requirement that they are imposing other than what already exists under the existing NERC standards.
Thank you.
Can I back way up out of the weeds and just ask a really much more basic question about FERC's authority to enact this part of the rule under Section 206. Is it a practice affecting rates? Is it a practice creating discrimination? Both, I take those to be alternative arguments. And can you just spin that out with a little more concreteness, what the basis of your regulatory authority here is?
It is both, Your Honor. In the first place, it is the same as really the planning process itself. It's an effect on rates that you exclude from the regional process, people who are able to bring new projects, new ideas, better projects, more cost-effective projects to the process. And then there is a separate justification, which is that is the commission found that it was unduly discriminatory to treat the non-incumbent developers differently than the incumbent developers with regard to the ability to recover cost of service rates.
Just under the text of the statute, the discrimination I thought that it was addressing was discrimination among ratepayers. And here you're talking about discrimination among potential transmission facility constructors. And I just wonder how that might apply, given am I wrong about the way I'm reading the statute, that the discrimination that's talking about is a rate-based discrimination, not a inputs into the grid discrimination?
Well, the statute, Your Honor, I mean, as we have been discussing, the statute says a practice affecting a rate. And it doesn't say anything about that it has to be discrimination among customers. It doesn't, as was discussed earlier, the word customer doesn't appear in the statute anywhere. And it's discrimination that is, well, it is clearly rate-related, both in the impact on the rates from not including them in the process, and it's also the discrimination is specifically with regard to their ability to recover cost of service rates.
Well, but it's talking about a rate that's discriminatory, and who pays a rate is a ratepayer. And so if the rate, I could see, I think I understand the logic of the rate being unjust in the sense of just higher than it would otherwise be. Is that right? Because you're foregoing, without this getting rid of the right of first refusal, FERC's theory is that you're foregoing cost-effective and efficient and creative projects.
Right.
I'm still trying to, maybe because it's an alternative argument we don't go there, but I'm still trying to understand your alternative argument that the rate would be discriminatory, because
Your Honor, the discrimination is as between the non-incumbent developers and the incumbent developers.
And I'm just trying to square that with the statute, where remedying that kind of discrimination is anywhere addressed in Section 206.
Your Honor, it is practice affecting a rate. And
right.
This is discrimination which we have given several bases for why it has a rate effect. There's nothing in the statute that limits it to discrimination between customers as with regard to the rate. And that is the point that was made earlier just about, there's no limitation in the statute as to anything other than it has to be a practice that is affecting the rate. And this
affects the rate in one of four ways. It makes the rate unjust or unreasonable or unduly discriminatory or preferential. And I had thought you were making an argument about that kind of discrimination, but maybe I'm hashing it up. If the rate is discriminatory, that means some customers are paying more, some customers less. And I'm just wondering how discrimination between potential parties that would construct a project would cause that kind of effect on rates. But I may be up the wrong road here.
Well, and the argument is, Your Honor, is that there is no such limitation on what undue discrimination can address. And this is the Global Crossing Supreme Court case that we cited in our brief. It discusses whether practice in a very similar statute is limited in any way to customers as opposed to, in that case, a supplier of communication service. And the court found that there was no such limitation in the statute. And in cases, and this court has applied the non-discrimination provisions in cases that did not involve rate discrimination between customers. For example, in the Dynegy case, which is cited in our brief at 633 F3rd at 1127, the discrimination there was between the generators who were supplying reactive power to the ISO, and the point was some of the generators were being paid differently than others. But they weren't customers of the ISO. They were suppliers of the ISO. But still, there was, it was discriminatory. It was a non-discrimination requirement within 206 that they be treated equally in terms of the compensation they were receiving.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Mr. Shepard?
Right, we have the interveners first.
Sorry. How did I overlook that, Mr. Engelman? Sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. Much of the room doesn't want me here. Mike Engelman, on behalf of LS Power Transmission, LS Power Transmission Holdings, both independent transmission developers, and them and their affiliates have been directly affected by the barriers to entry that Order 1000 was intended to stop. We've had projects taken from us. We've had projects that we were not able to pursue, and we've made the decision in some areas to just simply step out of the planning process because we weren't going to get the projects. And the rules that FERC put in place here balance the interest of both the incumbent transmission owners and ratepayers on how to address finding the more efficient and cost-effective project. And we have to remember that that's the key to Order 1000, is determining for regional cost-allocated projects, and that's the other key, that this is only for regional cost-allocated projects, what is the more efficient and cost-effective solution. And what the Commission determined is, because of barriers to entry, like rights of first refusal, the only way to determine the more efficient and cost-effective solution is to, one, remove that barrier, and two, grant any project developer, whether it's incumbent or non-incumbent, the right to acquire regional cost allocation. So there's a direct connection between what the issue that FERC was trying to solve, which is finding the more efficient and cost-effective project for regional cost allocation, a direct connection to ratepayers, and the removal of the right of first refusal, because those rights of first refusal prevent clients like mine from participating in the process, from moving forward projects that are more efficient or cost-effective, or in some cases even proposing those. There's been discussion about 890 in the open planning process. Planning costs a lot of money. My client spends tens of thousands of dollars on each project it proposes. If it cannot keep that project, there's no incentive for it to spend that money.
Is there no, this is a little far afield, but is there no intellectual property or somehow, you know, other legal protection for, you know, a project that is yours to keep it from being taken from you?
There's no effective
or interference with business relations, or I don't know.
Yeah, there's no effective solution to that. And in some ways that goes to the issue of whether or not there can be, whether there should be individual complaints about these issues. And this is a systemic rule, a rule across multiple regions. This is not an instance where one particular entity refused to deal with this or engaged in discriminatory conduct. This is a rule in multiple regions that says you can't play in our sandbox. And it's also not an issue about choosing a business model, merchant versus cost of service. We could choose a merchant model. LS Power has developed merchant transmission. LS Power is also a cost of service transmission provider in Texas under cost of service rates after a competitive process. Texas isn't covered by FERC's jurisdiction in that, but FERC certainly looked at the Texas process because we put it in the record as a showing where new opportunities can arise. I'm out of time. I'm happy to address all of the arguments, Mr. Shepard, Ray, because I think there are answers to all of those arguments about similarly situated, about reliability issues, all of those issues. But I recognize my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. First, I'd like to address FERC's response that they don't find any
this is
prohibition.
Mr. Shepard. Right?
Yes, ma'am.
Just for the record.
Yes, ma'am. John Shepard, PSEG, et al. I'd first like to address FERC's claim that it sees nothing in the statute stopping it from being able to regulate in this manner. That turns administrative law on its head. The This Court has said repeatedly in Atlantic City and numerous other decisions, FERC's a creature of statute, is only those authorities that Congress chooses to give it. I think I've heard nothing to answer our arguments that there is nothing in the Federal Power Act that gives them the opportunity to or the authority to act in this realm. Judge Pillard, I thought you raised an extremely important point that I wish we'd had more time to discuss the first time around. The Federal Power Act does not have a special protection for competition between asserted potential competitors. This is not a situation where we're talking about commodity suppliers who need open access to the market through a choke point, namely the delivery system. That's where the natural monopoly exists. It does not exist at the supply stage. There are plenty of cases that talk about the distinction between natural monopolies and commodity supply in that regard. I'm sure that you and your clerks can get a hold of those fairly quickly. The four cases that FERC decided to marshal in its respondent brief on this subject do not address the sort of situation that you would expect them to address in response to your question. They involve competition. They involve generators or customers as consumers. In the one case, Energy Midwest, that was a straightforward fight between generators about the way they're going to be compensated for reactive power. An excellent decision. We've heard them again mention this question about Global Crossing. As we pointed out on page 10 of our reply brief, I'm happy that they brought Global Crossing again because, quite unlike this case, the Federal Communications Act gives the FCC direct authority to act in the manner that it did in that case. Finally, and just briefly, FERC is saying that it is trying to create the introduction of better ideas into the transmission process. What it is doing instead is creating transmission planning by litigation, and it is undermining reliability. The bench asked several good questions about the manner in which reliability is treated under Order Number 1000, and the answer ultimately is this. There is no reliability problem because we're not making you do anything you don't already have to do, because if these guys pick up your system and break it, you're responsible for fixing it. The Court has no more questions at all.
All right. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.